Hey folks, as you know, I am a new cat owner of two cat brothers, and I'm starting to really fall in love with them. It's been a few months, and now it's getting serious, and I want to give them exactly the right kind of food. I'm learning as I go. I've only had dogs growing up, so it's helpful that we have a sponsor like Smalls. This podcast is sponsored by Smalls. Listeners know that my cats simply cannot live without Smalls. Same with Sam's cat. Eating it all up. And for a limited time, get 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/majority. Smalls cat food is protein packed and their recipes are made with preservative-free ingredients you could find in your fridge. And it's delivered right to your door. That's why Cats.com has named Smalls their best overall cat food. And starting with Smalls is easy. Just share info about your cat's diet, health, and food preferences. Then Smalls puts together a personalized sampler for your cat. No more picking between random brands at the store. Smalls has the right food to satisfy any cat's cravings. I mean, you look at some of the labels on some of these things and you go, what the heck is that? Sometimes cats have some issues with their gut or even like issues with their hydration, which is why the Smalls little juice that you can squirt on there doesn't sound that appetizing for us, but it's very good for them.
Oh
Matt
yeah,
knows.
they go
They go
just
nuts for it.
crazy for it.
It's very helpful because that just like a little bit of moisture in their food really helps them stay moisturized. Still not a believer in Smalls. Forbes ranks Smalls the best overall cat food. While BuzzFeed said, my cats went completely ballistic for this stuff. And I can say the same.
It's a good word for it. It's like when, I don't know, if you sometimes give your cat, like, I don't know, a little piece of like a chicken sandwich or whatever, so they become trained to know that they can get something from
Right,
you when you
right.
have that. They react the same way when you go to the Smalls, like, juice that you put on the dry food.
Yes, and they also have a bunch of amazing treats and snacks that you can add to your order, more than just all of that great food that keeps their coat shiny, keeps them healthy. My cats love those. Oh God, what were they? Chicken treats that came in the most recent Smalls box, but it's a little holiday gift for them. And after switching to Smalls, 88% of cat owners reported overall health improvements. That is a big deal. And the team at Smalls is so confident your cat will love their product. You can try it risk-free. That means they will refund you if your cat won't eat their food. What are you waiting for? Give your cat the food they deserve for a limited time because you are a Majority Report listener. Get 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/majority. One last time, that's 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/majority. And we will put a link down below in the episode and YouTube description. And people are pointing out that I said moisturize instead of hydrated. So doing great, meant hydrated. Again, for a limited time, get 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/majority. And now, time for the show.
With Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, December 4th, 2025. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, steps, from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Clay Risen, author of Red Scare, Blacklist McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America, will be with us. And we're still TBD. We had a bit of a scheduling issue, but potentially somebody from the National Day Laborers Organizing Network will be with us.
They're a little busy with things.
With organizing, yes. So don't hold it against them, folks. But we shall see on that front. Otherwise, we have other news to get to. Also on the program, consulting firm Challenger finds that U.S. job cuts have topped $1 million. I mean, 1 million. 1 million people, Jesus, this year. The highest since the height of COVID, and up over 50% when you compare it to 2024. So, economy's not doing great.
Give it time.
The girls are coming for Mike Johnson. Female Republicans say the fundamentalist evangelical leader isn't respectful of them. Nancy Mace, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and the like. Oh, and women. Stefanik, most notably.
Women, am I right, guys?
Yeah.
Well, for Mike Johnson, gosh darn it, women?
Yeah. Right. Witches.
Succubus.
Inspector General's report on Pete Hegseth's use of Signal is about to be released, concluding that he committed some wrongdoing. The New York Times sues the Pentagon over its censorious press restrictions. Trump pardons a corrupt real estate developer indicted just months ago by his own DOJ. I see myself in you. AT&T promises to end its DEI practices, just coincidentally. AT&T needs FCC approval for a proposed $1 billion purchase of wireless spectrum assets. CDC advisors meet today on whether or not to scrap hepatitis B vaccine recommendations for newborns. That has saved millions of lives globally.
But at what cost?
Literally no cost, buddy. Democrats release images of Epstein Island, and the DOJ dodges questions about the files ahead of that December 19th deadline for their release. Trump renames the Institute of Peace after himself. I don't have much more detail.
I've got a great piece.
Didn't you see my hands?
Sorry, not doing the headlines.
Brent, don't apologize. That's my thing, to constantly say sorry. Israel bombs Gaza and Lebanon overnight, violating both ceasefires continuously, over and over and over and over again.
What does the word cease mean?
Yeah. And lastly, on this day in 1969, Fred Hampton of the Black Panther Party was drugged and killed by the FBI and Chicago police. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. It's an M Majority Report Thursday, so happy to be with you. We will get right into it. Biggest story of the day is that, well, I mean, last night there were a few major stories that ended up breaking in legacy media publications. And when I see something like this, or just the past few weeks, really starting since the Epstein vote, which has also triggered Trump enormously. I mean, this is where he's been. That's when the Quiet Piggy happened. This is when his Trump Truth Social posting sprees were happening. His most emotional meltdowns seem to have been triggered by his inability to quash this. And having essentially the entire legislative body of Republicans revolt against him because the base wanted this and he was unable to assuage them because he's likely very much implicated. And so now we're starting to see, and also, of course, the election results being so poor for Republicans across the board, the Trump administration starting to leak like a sieve. They had a lid on this stuff for a little while, but they're worrying. The rats are scurrying here. Matt, you want to say something?
Well, I was just going to say, you know, at some point, we talked about like the Steve Bannon thing from earlier this year where he said, you know, people are just going to have to get used to it. Trump's going to be the president 2028 to 2032. And that is, I think, a threat against democracy, and that should be taken seriously. But it's also something that Trump needs to say, because the second that people start looking at him as a lame duck and thinking about, well, what's after this, his power starts to evaporate extremely quickly. And I think, like, a lot of these cracks we're seeing now is because of that.
100%. I mean, he is careening towards lame duck territory, and the first year of his presidency isn't even...
What was that? Sorry.
And by careening, I mean a Secret Service person is driving a golf cart really fast. He's not able to careen at this point. Walking might be hard too, right? We've seen that limp. His health is obviously deteriorating, but this Inspector General's report is also making a lot of waves here. There was a multi-month investigation by the Pentagon's internal watchdog about Pete Hegseth sending classified information over Signal, if you'll remember that story, you know, the one where he added the reporter from The Atlantic, as well as his wife and brother, by the way, to a commercially available chat on Signal, you know, or the app Signal's commercially available, point being, and not secure for this kind of thing.
Not through official channels.
You're not supposed to be talking about airstrikes on Signal.
It should be through a communications platforms that can be, like, easily recovered in case you need to maybe investigate war crimes or something like that.
I mean, this is why they're using Signal. They're not using their official channels. And that is what this Inspector General report ended up finding. Like, they didn't necessarily deal with all of the potential illegalities here. But they basically found that he was using his personal device for official business, and that he put military personnel, U.S. military personnel, in danger here. And the document...
Just to point out, like, there was, like, times that the planes carrying the bombs were leaving the aircraft carriers and stuff like that, which is, like, I don't know what more you need to know.
Exactly. And there was the full classified report was shared with the House and Senate Armed Services Committees yesterday. It appears like it's likely to come out today. And here is Representative Mike Turner of Ohio, high up on the Armed Services Committee in the House, on Morning Joe this morning. And listen to this tone about this compared to how Republicans have spoken about Trump's brazenly illegal actions in the months prior to this.
Start by asking you what are the top one or two questions that you would like answered that Pete Hegseth has refused to answer for the Armed Services Committees in the House and Senate?
Well, Joe, as you just indicated, I mean, as you were going over some of the scenarios and some of the outcomes that are concerning here, you can understand that the discussions that are happening between members of Congress. You know, we start first with the legal opinion under which these attacks on these boats first began. And members of Congress had questions as to whether or not the validity of the legal opinion, the construct of the legal opinion, and then the operations that were being undertaken under the constructs of legal opinion. And then the questions that arose after the questions of this second tap or however many taps it was that may have occurred here, that clearly, you know, fall under the law of war manual, under the questions of the circumstances of this act. But what's really clear here is that, you know, this is not necessarily the normal rules of engagement. This is not a battlefield, and where they're undertaking these attacks under, you know, what is this issue of attacking the drug trade. You know, this is not the normal you know, construct that we have of terrorism, where we think of, like, ISIS or Afghanistan or Iraq. So there's very much concerns where we all go back to the issue of the intelligence and what intelligence is being used. What do we really know about these individuals? What do we know about this cargo? What do we know about the communications that here? And quite frankly, many members have very much concerns as to whether or not the accuracy of what information is being used is to the level for us to even know what's happening in this area. And members are very concerned.
You know, Mr. Chairman,
that's good. I should have set that up a little bit better. That was about the other blatantly illegal action that this Department of Defense has taken. That was about the Venezuela boat strikes, which they're also going to be looking into. We this morning, it was revealed that that admiral, the Navy admiral, who Hegseth threw under the bus and basically said, we stand by you 100%, Admiral Bradley.
Frank Mitch Bradley.
Yeah.
The decision that you made.
The decision that you
that
made.
That I wasn't in the room for, that I didn't see.
Right.
Even stick around, man.
I was in the room. I just gave the general vibe that I wanted you to do it, but I didn't tell you to do this illegal action.
He did the right thing, but just remember the fog of war.
Right. In the conference room. So he's going to be basically testifying today on.
And we should just say, since it's Pete Hegseth we're talking about, he's a black guy.
Oh, no, that's a different admiral.
Oh,
we're getting
one.
All... See, this is what I'm saying.
Sorry.
There's a big stew of not... This Admiral Bradley is not. He's going to be testifying. We'll see what he says, because I would be pretty pissed if I were him.
Gotcha.
If you had this, like, completely incompetent booze hound blaming
TV
me.
TV star?
Yeah, saving your skin so publicly, his own skin so publicly, and throwing you under the bus... It'll be interesting to see, I think, both the tenor of the Republicans' questions towards him and his reaction to them, obviously. But the story that Matt is alluding to there is, again, another legacy publication. The Wall Street Journal had a story last night about Pete Hegseth. This is when I talk about the rats scurrying here. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth shocked official Washington in mid-October when he announced that the four-star head of U.S. military operations in the Caribbean was retiring less than a year into his tenure. But according to two Pentagon officials, Hegseth asked Admiral Alvin Halsey to step down, a de facto ouster that was the culmination of months of discord between Hegseth and the officer. It began days after President Trump's inauguration in January and intensified months later when Halsey had initial concerns about the legality of lethal strikes on alleged drug boats in the Caribbean, according to former officials aware of the discussions. Not long after, Hegseth announced that Halsey would be retiring. He, I think, was the first black man in his position.
Gotcha.
This is obviously not a coincidence. The Trump administration has been just attacking both senior black officials across a variety of different agencies, but also, like, the first in their position to be black.
The Kill Bill
alarm
goes
off. Lisa
Cook,
for example.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And, I mean, it's just between them openly tweeting out very obvious Nazi phrases from official accounts, it's just...
They're Klansmen.
It sounds rote, but we can't talk about this administration without talk about the deep white supremacy that is embedded in it across a variety of different agencies. And just so you know, this guy wasn't just, like, too woke or something. The admiral, the guy who's like a multi-decade veteran of the Navy. The admiral, a 60-year-old Navy helicopter pilot nicknamed Bull, total softy, had seemed a good fit to carry out Trump's military campaign against drug traffickers after the new president came into office. Halsey voiced support for stepping up interdiction of drug shipments and had experience at such missions. My first deployment to the Southcom area of responsibility was over 33 years ago, conducting counter-drug missions, he told lawmakers at his Senate confirmation during September 2024, arguing for a more muscular approach to dismantle the drug cartels responsible for tens of thousands of American deaths. You would think that this would be a perfect fit with the Trump administration, but no. Later in the summer, as the military began striking alleged drug boats, Halsey was initially concerned about murky legal authority for the boat strike campaign, according to former officials. With other military units under separate chains of command also involved, including elite special operations units, Halsey objected that parts of the operations fell outside his direct control, they said. But even before the boat strikes began, Hegseth had lost confidence in Halsey and was looking to replace him, according to a U.S. official.
He lost. Did he ever have confidence in him?
There's something about... I can't put my finger on it. It's like the Stavi bit about the guys in Maryland who just love Joe Flacco but can't get behind Lamar. There's something about him that I can't...
Like a pocket presence.
I like a big-armed white guy. That's just... Is he a wide receiver? I can't do a Baltimore accent. I'm just dangerously approaching trying to do an impression. But yeah, That's the vibe here. And so we'll see what happens with Pete Hegseth. I do think it's interesting that this is where they're kind of, I think, directing the energy. He's under a lot of fire right now, so much so that he had to go on Katie Miller's podcast. We'll play that maybe a little bit later to talk about how he's a family man. He brought his wife on. Mm-hmm. He brought his wife on. And then said, "I wouldn't trust your husband to babysit my kids." So, and to be fair to Hexa,
French braided through the whole interview too. It's so gross.
Right. So this is not the ex-wife that said that he was abusive. This is the new ex-wife.
Yeah, I'm sure. Okay. I'm sure she'll say that in 4 years.
Or not the other ex-wife who he was with when there was the rape allegation against him and the police report and the woman that said he drugged him and she went to a nurse and everything about it. It wasn't that one. I'm get all of the women that he's allegedly harmed. Confused.
Speaking of women, he does still have the same mother that sent that email in 2018 about all that stuff, right? That
yeah.
people can look at.
She retracted it, though, when, you know, it was an opportunity for her son to be Secretary of War.
Some things are hard to retract. I don't know.
Some things are. Yeah. In a moment, we will be talking to Clay Risen. First, a word from some of our sponsors. It can be so easy to say to myself that, you know, I'll never forget to ask my parents about stories, about them growing up and having all of this, these memories cataloged. And you just kind of put it off and you don't like to think about it because it could be a little bit morbid and sad. But I did this, I think, two holidays ago, Storyworth, and it just was exactly what I needed to kind of make sure that I had my loved ones, I don't know, just memories or their experience kind of categorized. It's perfect. I recommend Storyworth Memoirs for your loved ones this holiday season. It's a meaningful gift, and it may sound intimidating, but it's so easy, they will love it. It's a gift they won't see coming, something that makes them feel truly special. Each week, Storyworth emails a loved one a memory-provoking question that you get to choose. Questions like, what were your favorite toys as a child? What are you most proud of? And all your loved one needs to do is respond to that email with a story. They can either write a story over email and record it over the phone for Storyworth to transcribe. And there are no apps to install or passwords required, so it's perfect for even the less tech-savvy relatives. After a year, Storyworth compiles your loved one's stories and photos into a beautiful keepsake hardcover book. Photos are printed in vibrant color. It's a treasure that your loved one and you will be able to share and revisit for generations. This year, Storyworth added a bunch of new features to make storytelling even easier with their magic layout and new book designs make finished books, and especially photos, look even more beautiful. Plus, they've rolled out a Spanish language support version. Storyworth has printed over 1 million books and preserved 35 million family stories since their founding 13 years ago. They have over 48,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot. And as I mentioned, this was a great gift for me, for one of my family members around 2 years ago. And now I'm thinking, with these new features, maybe I double dip here. I'd like to thank Storyworth for sponsoring today's episode. Storyworth is the perfect gift for the people you love. Give your loved ones a unique keepsake you'll all cherish for years, Storyworth Memoirs. Right now, save $10 or more during their holiday sale when you go to storyworth.com/majority. That's storyworth.com/majority to save $10 or more on your order. Link down below in the video and episode descriptions and at majority.fm. And also, I would like to thank OneSkin for sponsoring today's episode. If you are like me, your skin needs some extra care this time of year. I'm getting all dry. I also am not sometimes that good about not, you know, I like to sunbathe a little bit. And I need to rely on OneSkin, especially in the winter months, if I want to recover. You know I love that OS1 face one and that OS1 eye one. That has been invaluable to my daily routine and delivers both powerful skincare and longevity. I love the texture of it. It's creamy, but it's light. You just need a tiny bit to cover your whole face for the OS1 face. And then for the OS1 eye, I've said this before, eye creams are very difficult to find because that skin is very sensitive, especially on your eyelids. And when this OS1 eye is really just like the best eye cream that I've ever used. At the core is their patented OS1 peptide, the first ingredient proven to target senescent cells, the root cause of wrinkles, crepiness, and a loss of elasticity, which are all signs of skin aging. And the results have been validated in 5 different clinical studies. It's super easy. You just cleanse, you pat your skin dry, and apply twice daily. The packaging is awesome. You get this reusable shell. It's just a couple of pumps, and it goes on smoothly and easily. And OneSkin also just launched their limited edition holiday sets, including the Nightly Rewind gift set, which is one of those rare gifts that's both impressive and genuinely useful, providing an upgrade to anyone's nightly routine, featuring their best-selling face moisturizer, their new peptide lip mask, and a cooling gua sha tool. Each component of the set is designed to work together as your body enters its natural nightly repair mode, helping renew skin at the cellular level for a stronger, smoother, more resilient skin. That's the kind of gift, these limited edition holiday sets, that I am going to be looking into. No spoilers to my family. This season, don't just moisturize, support your skin at the cellular level with OneSkin. For a limited time, try OneSkin for 15% off using code MAJORITY at oneskin.co/majority. That's 15% off at oneskin.co/majority with code MAJORITY. After you purchase, they will ask you where you heard about them. Please help us out and tell them the Majority Report sent you. Try OneSkin today. Link down below in the video and episode description. And lastly, here's my holiday pattern. I'll tell myself I'll be thoughtful, and then you start to panic at the last minute, and you get a gift card. It's not necessarily the most personal. That's the exact opposite of the personal gift that an Aura Frame is. It is sometimes hard where you just want to get a gift that means something to people, and the people you're closest to, somehow gets even harder the closer you are to them. And with Aura, you just have this amazing kind of gift to you as a gift to them, because it's personalized just in its inception. You can add a message before it arrives with the Aura Frame and load up photos and videos effortlessly straight from your phone all year long, and you can do it in the box. You don't need to open the box first. It's the digital picture frame that will make your family members, extended family, feel like, yeah, you're thinking of me. You miss me, even if we live across the country. I don't see you, etc. You can't wrap togetherness, but you can frame it. For a limited time, save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $35 off Aura's best-selling Carver Matte Frames, named number one by Wirecutter, by using promo code MAJORITY at checkout. That's AuraFrames.com, promo code MAJORITY. This deal is exclusive to listeners, and frames sell out fast, so order yours now to get it in time for the holidays. Support the show by mentioning us at checkout. Terms and conditions apply, but we will put a link down below. These Aura Frames are amazing. Sam has gotten them for many a family member. I have as well. And that is, use the code MAJORITY at checkout. That's AuraFrames.com, promo code MAJORITY. This deal is exclusive to listeners, and the frames sell out fast. Check out the episode and YouTube descriptions and at majority.fm for the link down below. Promo code MAJORITY. Quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Clay Rise. We are back, and we are joined now by Clay Risen, reporter and editor at the New York Times, author of Red Scare, Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. Clay, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Of course. You know, I've been thinking a lot about, like, the Red Scare and, of course, McCarthyism over the past few years with, and in an accelerated manner, in the last year, given the fact that the Trump administration has been openly prosecuting people, locking people up for their political speech, particularly on the issue of Israel's genocide in Gaza. And what I loved about your book is that it talks about McCarthyism in a way that isn't just this kind of more narrow focus on Hollywood or the blacklist, which is a really important tale, but it's been done before. And it almost expands it a bit to like how the Red Scare was in many ways also a cultural war against like the labor movement, progress in general. And it's so eerie because it's very similar in many ways to the Trump era and builds on that. And you see how he learned from Roy Cohn and how Stephen Miller learned from that. I mean, history is always kind of replicating itself, I guess, is where I land here. But just, you know, why did you want to take that tack? And why did you, what elements of the Red Scare and McCarthyism did you think people didn't fully understand?
Yeah, I mean, originally I had not planned to write this book as some sort of resonance to the present. You know, I started this back in the first Trump administration, and I, you know, look, there are echoes, there are always sort of, you know, things in the water, but I had no idea that it would be so on the nose in 2025. You know, the book finished last year, but look, I think the thing that I was very interested in throughout working on the project was that, you know, the Red Scare, there were reasons or good reasons to be concerned about Soviet espionage and subversion. But what happened during the Red Scare was that these fairly specific concerns that were counterintelligence, law enforcement issues, became the pretext for a much more sweeping attack on progressive ideas, on the New Deal, on the political establishment after World War II. And I think that's one of the things people don't understand about the Red Scare. They don't sort of see the broadness of it. But also, I think that's one of the ways that it echoes today. I think you see a lot of that kind of, you know, these specific concerns about, you know, drug trafficking or about, you know, illegal or undocumented immigration, you know, becoming pretexts for much broader assaults on large communities across the United States.
Well, and when you talk about drug trafficking, that there's still that outside invader quality to it as well, right? And you know, you look at I was struck by, of course, the anti-Semitism of the Red Scare. You know, the bloodlust for the execution of the Rosenbergs. You tell a story about Helen Bryan in your book. But how that echoes the great replacement rhetoric of today, which is both about Jewish puppet masters trying to change the culture or change the fabric of society.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about the Red Scare that immediately comes to the fore is that, you know, you're talking about espionage or subversion. There's no ethnic character to it per se, but it immediately became an excuse for anti-Semites and anti-Semitism to come to the fore, you know, as well as anti-Black racism. There's nothing particularly, there's no reason why that has to enter the conversation, and yet very quickly it did. And it just gives a lie to the idea that really all that was going on was this hunt for, you know, subversion and spies. It was really much broader. It was a pretext for attacking civil rights, labor rights, women's rights. It was a pretext for anti-Semitic attacks. And again, I think that, look, it's hard not to see those echoes in 2025.
Certainly not. And can you give us then just back up a little bit about the context of the Red Scare and McCarthyism in even, you know, or I guess the second one, but post-war America, the New Deal era, what that environment looked like as, you know, you saw this escalate?
Yeah, so following World War II, there was the immediate onset of the Cold War and tensions with the Soviet Union, and pretty solid evidence the Soviet Union was had at various points in the past infiltrated spies into the United States, that it did have an arm domestically in the American Communist Party. And, you know, this synced up with what had been a kind of simmering anti-progressive campaign going back to the 1930s. And, you know, a real sort of backlash against everything that the New Deal represented, you know, not just new policies and not just a new role for the government, but also a new culture that was more tolerant, more cosmopolitan, more progressive in all its approaches to, you know, minority rights and to, you know, women and people of color. And so, you know, that fight had been kind of put on the back burner because of the Great Depression and World War II. And so it emerged as well in the post-war era. And so the Red Scare is really the coming together of these two urgencies, right? This need for national security in the Cold War era and the fear of communist Russia or the Soviet Union as a national security issue. And then this idea that we could use that as a reason to start to prosecute this campaign, this idea to push back not just the New Deal as a policy framework, but really to push back on these cultural changes that had happened, that, you know, there were a lot of people who wanted to go back to the America of the 1920s, the America of, you know, that was more patriarchal, that was more, you know, white, run by white men.
That wealth was, concentration, very, very similar to now. Yeah.
It's I think in some ways that fight didn't end with the end of the Red Scare. And it's something that, you know, still is an undercurrent in American politics.
I know that your book is about, of course, you know, more than the Hollywood element and the blacklist, but I am, you know, I am curious about a few elements of it. You talk about Ayn Rand in your book and the role that she played as a bit of a counterweight to these Hollywood lefties and she her role in Hollywood. But what did Hollywood elites and wealthy folks get out of McCarthyism? Was there any benefit to them to having this, I guess, the governmental crackdown on some of the artists in the industry? I mean, are they submerged in the story at all?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that one of the parallels between the fight in Hollywood and today is that a lot of the elites, or let's say a lot of the celebrities in Hollywood, were left-leaning and were seen as a kind of elite and were targeted for that reason. When in fact, the real elite in Hollywood, the real powerful elite, were the studio executives and the investors who owned the studios. And they were not progressive by any means. And they were very happy to see the Red Scare come to Hollywood, to see some of the activists and celebrities who had lined up behind union activism, who had tried to change the way that stories were told in Hollywood to bring more representation of women and people of color into the movie industry. You know, the elites, the real elites, were happy to see those voices quieted. And, you know, you mentioned Rand, and she was a real sort of, I want to call it an intellectual, but, you know, a real voice for outlining how the new Hollywood was going to look. And, you know, according to her, and she had a manifesto that laid this out, you know, the new Hollywood would not talk about wealth disparities. It would not talk about civil rights. It would not talk about the common man. And she was very successful. That is what you saw after the House Un-American Activities Committee came and kind of, you know, helped launch the blacklist. The stories coming out of Hollywood changed for well over a decade.
I mean, it's hard not, again, to see parallels to today, of course. And even the financialization of that industry, and perhaps we're at in a different era now, and there maybe less tolerance for the blacklisting that was happening, perhaps. It's less formal, right? But the attacks on those artists from maybe a year or so ago, it's still ongoing, but it was also at a time where the industry is rejecting more risky creative choices that might be a little bit more challenging in many ways for sequels, nostalgia, more... It's more financialized in a way.
Yeah, and one of the things, you know, we could just say this all day, one of the parallels or the echoes is the really rapid turn of events and the backlash in the way that, you know, the stories that were being told, the voices that were being heard just a few years ago, you know, have now been marginalized. And whether that's in Hollywood or in the classroom or just in the cultural discourse, things have changed dramatically. And the same thing happened during the Red Scare. People who were, you know, front and center in debates about, let's say, civil rights in the 1930s were suddenly added to the blacklists and were marginalized very quickly. And, you know, you sort of can look in both cases as to why that happened. And it's because elites simply saw a new opportunity to change the discourse and to start talking in a way that was more beneficial to them. And, you know, it can have long-running effects. I mean, this is not something that will change based on the midterm elections.
Well, and it's also, I mean, you write about how many of these stories, too, they included things like, you know, the liberation of women. And when we're coming out of World War II, where women were brought into the war effort and there's this new awareness, that's, I would imagine, immensely threatening, and more dignified portrayals of Black Americans as the civil rights movement is brewing. That's also a part of this as well. And you see how that the liberation of people or uplifting of those voices is a genuine threat to kind of the same people at the very top.
Yeah. I mean, one thing just to add to that, I have a chapter in the book talking about what's called the Lavender Scare. And this was a direct outgrowth of a surprising thawing of homophobic and anti-gay structures, particularly in the cities during the Great Depression and World War II, when it was possible, I mean, Washington, D.C. being first and foremost, where it was possible, as long as you were careful, and I'm not going to say it was some sort of utopia for gay men and queer people, but it was possible to live a life where you were kind of out. And there was a lot of change going on. And then there was an enormous backlash against all of that going into the 1950s. And it wasn't just cultural, it was governmental. There were just concerted efforts, very specific efforts, to root out gay men and lesbian women from government office and from government service. The State Department was target number one, and hundreds of people were fired simply because they were suspected of you know, not following gender norms. And, you know, one of the consequences of that is some really good, really hardworking and smart diplomats, people we needed during the Cold War, were suddenly fired. Their lives were essentially ended because of that.
And there's this overarching theme of a combination of, you know, more a more libertary economic situation for people, or people basically being uplifted in a variety of different ways, whether it's women, Black people, queer people, and then this just force of power, and it's under this guise of like rooting out moral degeneracy for the most part. But yeah, you see, I mean, Hoover was gay, and like you have that being used as blackmail potentially, or as a cudgel, I guess, against the lefties that were trying to change society.
Yeah, I mean, what happened during the Red Scare was this imposition of a real black and white ideology. And one that said, during the Cold War, there is one side and there's the other side. And you are either with America or you're against it. And it was then, you know, and that's bad in itself. But what that ideology then, what happened, it was then weaponized by people who, you know, saw it to their advantage to say, okay, in this column is going to be everything I like, and over in that column is going to be everything I don't like. And so labor rights and women's rights, they're going to go in the communist column. And we're just going to say that everybody who advocates for desegregation, they're going to be questioned. Everybody who we think might be gay, we were going to say that they might be communist, or because they might be blackmailed. They're going to go in the other column. And we're going to sort of do everything we can to oppress them and to marginalize them. And we're going to do it under the pretext of national security. So no one can really question what we're doing. This is, you know, this is the new era when we have to be vigilant. And it's just amazing how deep and how long that lasted as a way of ordering American society, how many people suffered because of that. And in the end, it didn't improve our national security at all.
Right. Can you talk a bit about education and how the Red Scare in that era, there was a war on different forms of education. We're seeing some of this today as well in terms of the parallels we've outlined.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that jumps out, just like today we have the Moms for Liberty, back then there was a group called the Minute Women. And the Minute Women was essentially the same idea. These were chapters around the country of anti-communist women, activists, who believed that they needed to take the fight to schools. And so they would either, go into school board meetings and, raise protests. They would try to take over school boards. And they would then, essentially impose their agenda, their ideology on schools and say, well, there are these books that we can no longer read. There were long lists of prescribed books that went around the country. And some of them, the justification was impossible to explain. You know, often it was the author themselves was somehow questionable or some the content was, too anti-elite or too focused on the common man, right? These were potentially communistic books, no different from today. And teachers themselves were targeted. You know, if you were a teacher who promoted desegregation or you thought the UN was a good idea, you might find yourself either investigated or even fired. Hundreds of teachers, even here right in New York City, were investigated and fired because of either beliefs and positions they took in the classroom or maybe something they had done as a college student, a petition they had signed. Suddenly, they were very much under the microscope, and it again not only ruined the lives of countless people, but it also did a great disservice to us as a country. Great teachers were suddenly kicked out of the profession for spurious reasons, right at the time when we always need great teachers, but arguably in the 1950s we really needed great teachers.
Right. Well, it's fascinating stuff. Really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for coming on. Clay Risen, the book is called Red Scare, Blacklist, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. We'll put a link to that down below wherever people are listening to or watching this. Holidays are coming up. Books are great to give. Thanks so much, Clay. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Quick break, folks. And when we come back, we do have a guest, fortunately, from the National Day Laborer Organizing Network. Chris Newman, their legal director, will join us in just a bit.
Right, live.
We are back. We are back. Joined now by Chris Newman, legal director for the National Day Laborer Organizing Network. Chris, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Of course. So just tell us a little bit about your work at the National Day Laborer Organizing Network, because we're seeing, you know, we're getting the numbers. There was a piece in Axios this morning about the incredible, in, not in a good way, influx of ICE arrests. They're primarily targeting people who have no criminal record. And even if the folks that they're also increasing and targeting, like they have an arrest, not necessarily a conviction, that kind of thing. And they're going after day laborers in particular, targeting them in area at stores like Home Depot. We've been showing some of that footage. What has your organization been doing on that front?
Well, first, I think it's important to accurately describe the crisis, because, you know, I'm zooming in from Los Angeles, and what we're experiencing in the city here is nothing short of a human rights crisis along the lines that you described. They're looking for areas where there are large numbers of Spanish-speaking, low-wage workers, non-white low-wage workers. They use this notion of criminality, oftentimes trying to identify one person as a pretext to then do a kind of arrest first and ask questions later approach, which is totally antithetical to every notion of due process and constitutional values that we have. And so locations such as day labor hiring sites, car washes, other locations where there are large groups of people tend to be the what they call target-rich environments. And so it's fair to say that the day labor community has been terrorized first in Los Angeles, but now as we're seeing, you know, it's spreading across the country. We've been doing everything we can with our scarce resources to rush to the gunfire and try to mitigate the unnecessary suffering that is being brought on by these raids. Ours is a network that is comprised of 70 small organizations around the country that work with day laborers. We kind of pool our resources. I've been the legal director there for 20 years, and I've never seen anything like the crisis that we are facing. On the other hand, the response of our members and supporters has been nothing short of inspirational. So what we do is we, in Los Angeles, first and foremost, we started something called the Immigrant Defense Fund, which I think you can find easily on Google. We ask for people to donate money, and then we make sure that low-wage workers get high-quality immigration defense in appropriate cases, and then we will sort of use those clients as places where we can get information to support other lawsuits as well.
We will put a link to that donation website that you mentioned down below and where people are listening to or watching this. But can you speak a little bit more about your organizing strategy in the wake of this level of the human rights violations, the targeted enforcement of this, the ICE budget now, the crazy expansion of it is now hitting, right? October, I think, was when the fiscal year started. So the budget that was agreed upon by the Republicans and some Democrats earlier this year is coming into effect. And then you're also seeing those quotas being more fulfilled in terms of the amount that these ICE agents are doing, targeting people. Like, what has this have these last 6 weeks looked like, even in comparison to the previous part of the year?
Well, there was a dramatic escalation across the country, but in particular in Los Angeles, both in scale and in violence. You got a little bit of an unlucky break that I'm filling in for my colleague, Jorge, who is one of our gifted organizers. Endelon is primarily an organizing network, but I happen to do the legal work. So I think I'll probably keep veering my answers that way, just kind of reflexively. But what we've done, which has really been magnificent, is we've created this kind of Adopt a Corner program where communities are coming together basically to defend their own towns and locations. And so we have, you know, soccer moms showing up to Home Depots with cameras, with Know Your Rights information, doing all of the rapid response kind of meager watch stuff. And those little committees are growing in sort of breadth and depth around the country, and it's been a beautiful thing to see, because I mean, what we're seeing obviously is a calamity that's being brought from the top down, and I think it's important, and I don't want to editorialize too much, to note that Trump is just sort of the capstone on a kind of bipartisan consensus war on immigrants that's taken place for over 25 years. And so it's not, I mean, people get divided. Is this like not normal, or is it like just an extension of what has been normal? And count me in the latter camp. And so I think people, who are, obviously part of the intention, the political project, is to divide people, divide communities physically, metaphorically, but to see communities coming together, organizing around individual cases, accompanying people to ICE hearings, raising money, passing the hat for legal defense, doing what we just did last week in Monrovia, which, incredible demonstration with a bunch of old, primarily elderly folks, doing an old-fashioned Alinsky-style buy-in at Home Depot, clogging Home Depot up to sort of make the point that Home Depot needs to be safe for everyone. So we're seeing, in general, what I've said repeatedly, I think it's true, is the leadership that we're seeing in definitely the LA, Chicago, other places, is leadership is coming from the streets, and we're just trying to support that leadership. And I think you've seen, for example, in Illinois, the governor and mayor have gotten the memo in a sense, and I think are following the lead of a community that's unifying and coming together. I think California leaders have been a little slower, frankly.
Can you expand on that? Because I think that's an important point, right? I do think that the way that Pritzker and Johnson responded was more unified than anything we saw coming out of Newsom and Bass. And it feels like they're lagging a little bit in protecting the community.
Oh, to say the least, honestly. And remember, Mayor Bass had, her approval rating was in the dumps. After the fire, people were very upset with how slow and uncoordinated the response to the fires were right when Trump took office. And in some ways, she's been buoyed by her show of support for immigrants, but she hasn't been doing the types of policy and legal interventions yet that we've seen in Chicago and Illinois, ditto with Governor Newsom. I'm not sure exactly.
Go on.
Honestly, can I just say, here's my one little like unsolicited hot take, since I'm on this podcast that I
editorialize away. This is what this is for.
I would love, we have two people that are clearly running for president in Newsom and Pritzker. And rather than like what we've had for the last 25 years with Democrats, which is just like pretty talk, lip service, posturing, kind of focus group tested messaging, I would like to see, starting now, a kind of scorecard where we measure the response of Newsom and Pritzker for the next 3 years, who did more to protect the residents of their states, the non-citizen residents of their states. And we'll start there when they go into the primary and evaluating before we hear what they're going to say about the DREAM Act or whatever. And it would be neat if we could get a kind of race to the top. We have, for example, in Seattle, the police chief there came out and made this incredibly courageous statement and show of solidarity, saying that he, anticipated potentially getting arrested to defend immigrants. People might be shocked to know Karen Bass appointed a Trump-supporting police chief in L.A., in Jim McDonnell, somebody who was the principal opponent of the sanctuary state bill that Endelon championed, that is protecting hundreds of thousands of people right now, preventing raids from taking place at police stations and sheriff's departments and jails. So LA does not have an ally in its police chief due to the really terrible decision of Karen Bass to appoint that guy, versus, again, you see a guy like the chief in Seattle. We should see, I hope, a race to the top in terms of actual material achievements by local elected officials, and obviously everyone is welcoming Mamdani. I had a chance to speak with the mayor elect. I had a sort of 5 minutes of fame working on Kilmer Brego Garcia's case, and I had a chance to talk to, it feels surreal to say, the mayor-elect at MSNBC in one of those green rooms, and he is the real deal. He's gonna, you know, he's an immigrant mayor, and he's gonna stand up for immigrants, and hopefully he will set a new bar that will then inspire, you know, Mayor Bass, Mayor Johnson, and other mayors to do more. So that's my little unsolicited plea for the political class not to, again, evaluate just all this messaging and kind of ethereal talk, which has kind of infected the politics of immigration from the Democratic Party side. We don't need shows of sympathy or solidarity or statements about dignity. We need material interventions that protect community residents like now. And there are lots of things that governors and mayors can do that hopefully they will be politically motivated to do in the next 3 years.
I think you can both make a positive case for immigration and return that to people's civic minds, which many Democrats are just not doing. I mean, Zoran Mamdani has been good on that, and that's just because he's, you know, he's pretty much good on everything. But, like, you know, there's no national messaging from the Democratic Party about how immigrants are our strength, that this is a nation of immigrants, the kind of stuff that you would hear about in history class or civics class or whatever when you were in high school. You don't hear that from the Democrats, and I want that to change. But the material kind of protections that you're talking about are of urgent importance. Can you explain what those look like in your experience, and what are some easy ways that this could happen?
Totally. But just before I get to that, I mean, it was a little bit triggering in your question. I'll take the messaging, the good messaging, too.
Yeah.
You know, I was down in El Salvador. I got detained with Senator Von Hollen when we were trying to access Kilmar Abrego Garcia outside of CECOT. By then, we were 3 weeks or so into what was a sustained effort, clearly by Trump, to kind of use, you know, Trump was using Kilmar to distract from whatever economic news. But we were responding. 3 weeks in, you know, and I'm talking about every day on the front page, and there was zero message guidance from the Democratic Party to members that were going on Meet the Press or whatever. And I know that for a fact. And so you get an absence of messaging. Thank God Senator Von Hollen set the gold standard and introduced the notion of, you know, due process and recognized the fact that Kilmar Abrego Garcia is a civil rights leader. He will be understood in history books as a civil rights leader for all of us. And I'm grateful to Senator Von Hollen for introducing that message. But we get nothing from, for example, Majority Leader Jeffries. And then when we do get something, we get what we got yesterday, which was like trash. I mean, him defending the Trump border record was just astonishing, jaw-dropping. No need for him to do that. But maybe, you know, he's listening to whatever think tank in D.C. is telling him, you know, to triangulate. Anyhow, so we do need better messaging, too. But the best way to have better messaging is to have good policies. And the first and best policy that you can have is something that prevents local police and sheriffs and criminal justice from cooperating with ICE, the so-called sanctuary policies. And we just won, again, the most recent legal challenge against the California policy yesterday. These have an undefeated record in federal court, something that easily jurisdictions can do. They can prohibit their local police and sheriffs from cooperating, because the way in which mass deportations are effectuated, and the reason why Obama deported more people in his first term than Trump did in his first term, was because they were using police as so-called force multipliers. You know, these fat guys that you see on television running around chasing people and, you know, at the Home Depots, there's only so many of them, and they can only get so many people. But if they can use every squad car, every police in a city, you know, now all of a sudden you're talking about mass deportations. So that's the first thing. Other things you can do are, for example, like something we did in Los Angeles, you can require that big box stores where big box construction stores like Home Depot, you can require that they build shelters and day labor centers. So Los Angeles has an ordinance, believe it or not, that requires if Home Depot is to build another store in LA, that they have to build a shelter and a safe place for day laborers. That's something that cities can do. There's been a lot of interest in Home Depot lately. That's a policy intervention as well. I think that there's a whole array of things, and I could go on and on, but there are, in fact, good policies. There are lawsuits that can be filed, affirmative lawsuits that can be filed. I think it's been a mistake by some of these attorneys general to just merely jump in as amicus on lawsuits from the ACLU and lawsuits like some of ours. They could initiate their own lawsuits. I'll give you a perfect example. And again, not to keep like harping on my hometown mayor, who obviously does a lot of good too and is constrained. But that day, if you think back when they did that whole like military parade in MacArthur Park and down like, early on in June when they did the easily the city of Los Angeles could have filed a 10th Amendment lawsuit on that day, challenging the fact that they were doing a military parade, you know, and usurping city resources, but they didn't. So hopefully there will be, you know, a more legal capacity lent by local jurisdictions as well. And I do think also in the next 3 years, we're going to see some attorneys general and district attorneys distinguish themselves in this, you know, Trump 2.0 era.
Yep.
And again, not through kind talk, not through statements of sympathy, but through creative litigation. And whereas Trump won, there was this kind of flash of resistance, and then it kind of dissipated. It feels like, on a hopeful note, that there's a kind of steadier, more sustained material buildup that's happening this time around.
I do feel quite lucky here in New York to have, for our neighbors here, for us to have Letitia James, who has a pretty good track record of coming up with these kinds of creative legal ways to fight back against the Trump administration. Then she'll have buy-in from the mayor-elect, of course, Zoran Mamdani. So I'm thinking of you guys in L.A. I think, you know, the organizing, DSA, that kind of stuff, you're getting there. You're getting there. But it's, yeah, it's still lagging a bit. Go ahead.
My pitch to your listeners or viewers is, you know, obviously, if you go upstream of this whole, everyone's got their theory about what led to Trumpism. But you know, social isolation and an erosion of community are at the core of it, no matter if you're living in Nashville, LA, Chicago, wherever. And the one, again, hopeful and neat thing about getting involved in a hyper-local, you know, effort to defend your community is that you meet really cool people. You know, I remember when we were doing the fire response work, again, early when Trump was, I remember meeting people that literally did like a Tinder date at a mutual aid center. You know, there's cool kind of community building that can happen. And you can kind of fight that sense of powerlessness that we all have. I mean, for us, there's no point in doing anything. I mean, you were asking questions about the budget. I mean, we're monitoring what's happening in DC, but it's not like we're going to the halls of Congress, like lobbying members of Congress right now. No, I mean, at Endline, we are just working at a very hyper local level. And recognizing that if we do our work right, that the people, the kind of would-be victims of today are going to be the civil rights leaders of tomorrow. And hopefully, you know, there will be a time when we'll be able to come back with more collective strength and more collective buy-in from the American public for immigrant rights.
How can our audience help with your organizing network in terms of even, you know, long-term building, but also in the short-term rapid response with ICE terrorizing neighborhoods?
Well, I'd say that, I mean, there are several ways. The first is just to go to our website and donate and know that we are providing high-quality legal representation to people that otherwise wouldn't get it. You know, again, I'll kind of, since I'm, I don't hope, you know, so hopefully not speaking too much out of class, you know, there's an interesting thing happening in the kind of immigration bar right now, where it's sort of the best of times and worst of times. There are incredibly heroic immigration attorneys that are doing really creative legal work, habeas actions and the like, but there also are a lot of bottom feeder immigration lawyers right now that are taking people's money and you know, in hopeless cases. And so, you know, and that's a little bit of a taboo to talk about. But so, you know, we are definitely providing and linking people with high quality legal services. You can donate there. You can join our Adopt a Corner initiative. We have all kinds of, you know, I don't know, daily and weekly Zooms about how you can create a local committee, whether it's to just set, you know, go to your local school and help people pick up students after school, because a lot of parents are afraid to pick up their kids after school, or whether it's going to a Home Depot, or whether it's providing, you know, information at work sites or chasing around ICE, you can do that. You know, I think there are a number of ways, and we're trying to figure out ways to kind of onboard people. So I guess, you know, give money, give your time if you can, and if you can give your creativity, that helps too. You know, I in my own neighborhood, when the raid started, I just one of the first things I did, one of my heroes is Mike Davis, and he always says, you know, when in doubt, just go outside and start handing out flyers. And so I went all around Highland Park and passed out signs to businesses saying ICE is not welcome, you know, get a warrant before entering. And now if you go anywhere for coffee in Highland Park, you'll see those signs everywhere. So you can just literally walk around your neighborhood and with signs that you print at Kinko's and give them to your coffee shop and say, hey, I'm a customer here. Can you please put up a sign saying ICE is not welcome here? We're not going to serve coffee to ICE. Get a warrant. You know, so you don't necessarily even need, you know, 10, 20, 50 people to do a direct action. You can do something in an hour. We have flyers that you can download on our website for Home Depot. And if you're, you know, not in a position of privilege where you can boycott, you know, Home Depot, as many people are doing, if you have to go to Home Depot, you can go and pass out flyers on windshields of cars. It takes like, you know, 15 minutes and you can fill the entire parking lot of a Home Depot with signs saying ICE out of Home Depot, and the manager will get the message. So, you know, I think the key is to just take some action, because to me, my biggest fear, Emma, is that there's this sort of thing that's happening where people aren't clicking on the links anymore because they don't want to get bummed out, a little bit like kind of, I think, what happened with Gaza. Like,
yep.
It's like, yeah, it's terrible, but it, you know, there's nothing I can do about it. So therefore, mm-hmm. I'm going to click on a link about Taylor Swift and not, you know, the latest news of the atrocity in Gaza. And that, you know, that results not just in the dehumanization of the people who are being, you know, handcuffed and harmed unnecessarily. That results in the dehumanization of all of us. You know, it's like a piece of our humanity dies when we just decide, fuck it, like, let's yep. tune out. And the best solution to that is to take some small action, even if it's just sharing posts on a daily, you know, like putting it in people's face. Like, don't look away from this most recent story of a dreamer flying to Texas and being put into deportation, because I think we're all clearly collectively implicated. I mean, our taxpayers are funding these human rights violations, and the worst thing that could happen to us right now is that we become kind of desensitized or dehumanized ourselves into just a kind of complacency or sense of resignation.
Hear, hear. Chris Newman, legal director for the National Day Laborer Organizing Network. We will put a link to everything that you spoke about down below in the episode and YouTube descriptions and at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today, Chris.
Thank you for everything you're doing, and thank you for inviting me on. I really, really am grateful for the opportunity.
Oh, of course. Thank you for everything you're doing. appreciate it. Thanks so much, Chris. All right, with that, folks, we're going to wrap up the first hour, the free hour-ish, hour and 15-ish.
Change.
Hour and change of this program, and head into the fun half, where we will read your IMs and we'll maybe take a few calls. We shall see how it goes. Lots and lots of news, as always. As a reminder, this show relies on your support. If you go to jointhemajorityreport.com, you can chip in a little bit. We can keep having interviews like this, highlighting things like, you know, direct action, organizing, rapid response to ICE, talking about the genocide in Gaza, speaking about issues that some shows and others won't touch. You keep us independent. You keep us afloat. So join the majority report.com. Jesus. So abrasive. Sounds like a hey Brandon. It's like Hello. It's like a bird. You just
rule crimes
right in my caw caw. Like ducking for cover. Join the majoritireport.com. Brandon, hello.
Hello, hello.
How are you today and what's happening over on the discourse?
I'm doing incredibly well today. I hope you are doing well as well.
Yeah.
After our week off for last holiday, last Thursday.
Yes.
The YouTube channel's going well, I saw.
My YouTube channel's going well?
Yeah,
sometimes. Not as well. So I'm going to be honest with you. Not as well as I feel like it could be doing. But that's okay. Just my ego talking. But if you
also,
like
you don't promote it as
in,
much.
You've just got that grind set.
If you'd like to be, I like to keep humble. A lot of people say I'm the most humble host of a leftist show. And people say,
You've
like,
never
they,
seen anyone so humble.
They're afraid. They're afraid of how humble I am. But yeah, you know, just today I posted a clip of my lovely live stream that I host every day, Monday through Friday. So not every day, between 9 and 12 p.m. Eastern. So yeah, 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. Eastern. About like the inevitable pardon of Ghislaine Maxwell, Donald Trump's best friend's girlfriend and co-conspirator. So definitely go check that clip out if you need to refresh yourself regarding that case, especially as the new evidence comes out.
All right. Check it out. Hey, Matt Binder, what's happening over on your side of things?
I got to say, I also feel like my YouTube channel isn't as big as it should be.
I'm shadow banned.
Tonight, folks, 8:30 p.m. Eastern time. Tune in to youtube.com/Matt Binder to catch the newest episode of The Leftist Mafia. And subscribe to the channel to help make it as big as it should be.
All right. Right. Give Binder what he deserves.
Right.
Success.
I'm also humble, by the way.
Not good humble as me, though.
Right. Well, we'll debate this in the fun half. Matt Leck.
Humility measuring contest.
What's happening on Left Reckoning and then with Jacobin?
Left Reckoning, this week I did a conversation with Devin Thomas O'Shea about the new Thomas Pynchon book, Shadow Ticket, which follows a private eye in Milwaukee and the end of Prohibition and the rise of Nazism as he investigates things like a international cheese syndicate and Nazis. A really great book, a really great conversation with Thomas Pynchon, or with not Thomas Pynchon, I wish it was with Thomas Pynchon, with Devin Thomas O'Shea. And anybody who is of the literary mindset will want to check that out.
All right. We will see you in the fun half.
Okay, Emma, please.
Well, I feel that my voice is sorely lacking on the Majority Report.
Wait, whoa. Look, Sam is unpopular.
I do deserve a vacation at Disney World. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome Emma to the show.
It is Thursday.
I think you need to take over for Sam.
Yes, please.
Sir, I'm gonna pause you right there.
Wait, what?
You can't encourage Emma to live like this. And I'll tell you why.
So it's offered a twerk, sushi, and poker with the boys. Sushi and poker with the boys. Who was offered a tour?
Yeah.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
What?
Tour? Sushi and poker.
Tim's upset.
Tour?
Yeah.
Sushi and poker with the boys. Who was offered a tour? Sushi and
that's what we call the biz.
Tour? Sushi and poker with the boys.
Right.
Tour? Sushi and poker.
We're gonna get demonetized.
I just think that what you did to Tim Pool was mean.
Free speech.
That's not what we're about here. Look at how sad he's become now. You shouldn't even talk about it. I think you're responsible.
I probably am in a certain way, but let's get to the meltdown here.
Twerk, sushi, and poker with the boys.
Oh my god.
Twerk,
wow.
Sushi.
I'm sorry, I'm losing my fucking mind.
Who was offered a twerk?
Yeah.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
Logic.
Twerk, sushi, and poker with the boys. Boy.
Twerk. I think I'm like a little kid. I think I'm like a kid.
Twerk.
I think I'm like a little kid.
Had this debate 7,000 times.
A little kid. Think I'm like a little kid. Think I'm like a kid.
Twerk. I'm losing my fucking mind.
Some people just don't understand.
So I'm not trying to be a dick right now, but like, I absolutely think the U.S. should be providing meat.
with a wife and kids.
That's not what we're talking about here.
It's not a fun job. Twerk?
That's a real thing. That's real thing. Real thing.
Boss. Willy Wonka twerk?
That's a real thing. That's real thing. Real thing.
What's that offer to twerk?
That's a real thing. That's real thing. Real thing.
Boss. That's
a twerk.
A real thing.
That's real thing. Real thing.
Boss. That offer to twerk?
Ladies and gentlemen, Joe Rogan has done it again.
That offer to twerk?
That's a real thing. That's
poker with the boys.
I think he might be blowing it out of proportion.
Real thing.
That's
poker with the boys.
That offer to twerk?
That's a real thing.
That's
poker.
Let's go, Joe.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
Take it easy, then.
Twerk, sushi, and poker.
Things have really gotten out of hand.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
Delusional.
Twerk.
Deluded.
Sushi.
You don't have a clue as to what's going on.
Live YouTube.
Sam has
Twitch,
the weight of the world on his shoulders.
Poggers.
Sam doesn't want to do this show anymore.
Can't do it anymore.
It was so much easier when the Majority Report was just you. You were happy.
Let's change the subject.
Right. Rangers and Knicks are doing great.
Now shut up. Don't want people saying reckless things on your program.
That's
now,
one of the most difficult parts about this show.
This is a pro-killing podcast.
I'm thinking maybe it's time we bury the hatchet.
Left is best. Trump. Violet.
Twerk.
Don't be foolish and don't fucking tweet at me and don't bitch. The way Emma has cucked all of these people. Love it.
That's where my heart is, so yeah. I wrote my honors thesis about it.
Oh, she wrote an honors thesis. I should hand the main mic to you now.
You are to the right of me on foreign policy.
We already fund Israel, dude. Are you against us?
That's a tougher question. I don't have an answer to.
Incredible theme song.
I Bumbler.
Emma Viglin, absolutely one of my favorite people. Actually, not just in the game, like period.
Back.
We are back, folks. It is the fun half of the Majority Report. We'll read some IMs and then get into some clips. Kowalski from Nebraska. I don't get Binder nor Brandon's issues with not getting more YouTube views. My last video on Prairie Fire, Nebraska got 39K views. It's very really easy to be a creator, apparently. New video that dropped this Saturday, by the way. I have solved climate change. Oh, my goodness.
Farm content is its whole thing on YouTube. So, like, him, Kowalski bridging that gap between, like, political YouTube content and farming YouTube content. He's basically grabbing both audiences now.
He's audience farming. He's farming. Yeah. He's just doing what he knows best, farming.
Like, you thought taking a selfie video in the front of your truck was big? Try doing it in a combine. Harvester.
I'll tell you, folks. I don't request it for me. I request it for you, because I know for a fact it has the power to enrich lives. Like that's part of what being the most humble streamer on the left is. It's recognition that like what I do, it's like, okay. So you know when Jesus was on the cross,
I've
heard about that. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah,
it's not like that, but it's akin to it. So okay. You know,
it's in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an adjacent
I think
cross.
His akin is like the word like, but never mind.
I'm one of the other criminals.
Also, Kowalski's not lying. Here is this video here.
Let's go.
From Prairie Fire Kowalski. 3,800 subscribers, but this video, 39,000 9 days ago. The trade war forces a corporation to destroy town. GOP takes no action. And there's Kowalski, and you know what he is? This is an old rural America joke. He's outstanding in his field.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, I believe him. I mean, farming content does numbers by itself.
Matt. Matt looked me right in the eye as he did that. Both eyes looking right at me.
Alpha move.
I think, the answer is for this show just to move into the middle of a field at a farm. I mean, we just got to broadcast from a farm.
Children of the Corn posting is back in, folks.
I'd be down if I could get a suntan this summer. Stupid. Tony from Maine. Katie Miller and Stephen Miller are still together. Didn't she run off with Elon Musk for a little? Rumors.
I mean, Stephen likes that stuff.
Yeah, perhaps. Lion Rhino Camel says, please talk about Mike Lindell running for governor. maybe we'll save that for Sam.
I mean, I think he's
a real special place in his heart for Mike
Sam
Lindell.
Sam loves it. Look, if you want to see Sam laugh, just anytime we talk about Mike Lindell, it's like
he loves Mike Lindell. He loves Jim Brewer. Yeah.
I have a fan for these burnout drug addicts. I have a soft spot for him.
He's just running on fumes. There's really nothing much going on. The rest of his body seems to be working, but oh boy.
Yeah, the high performance.
Corey from Indiana. I listened to every MR video live this year, and MR was not mentioned in my annual recap conspiracy. We're seeing a lot of that. It might be an issue on our end. It might not be. I don't really.
It's probably us fucking something.
Yeah.
People were telling me the same thing. They were saying that, like, I'm showing up in their end of review, but the MR is not showing up despite watching more of yours. And so, you know.
On Spotify, you said.
Could it be 100 times you guys have called out Spotify over Joe Rogan?
No, apparently this is YouTube, but but I would not be shocked if we were not in people's Spotify Wrapped either.
Just another, we'll keep rising regardless.
Exactly.
Considering things that I say, I'm surprised.
Your boy Blue says, free have is 30% ad anyways. It's all good. It's the end of the year, folks. Sorry.
Join themajoritypurp.com if you want the audio without the ad.
Exactly. Yeah. Kentucky leftist Charles Booker from Kentucky just announced he's running again for U.S. Senate from the hood to the holler. He's previously run twice. First time was against Amy McGrath from McConnell's seat in 2020. I remember this run very well. The second time he won the primary but lost to Rand Paul. His politics are good. Medicare for all, $40,000 a year wage guarantee. He's good on police reform and economic populism. Consider having him on. I would love to have him on. Charles Booker, we were rooting for him hard in that primary with Amy McGrath, who is a
100%
horrendous candidate. Is she back? Is she throwing her hat back in the ring? Someone just writes her blank checks, and that someone seems to be Chuck Schumer to continuously lose in that state.
Yeah, it's embarrassing.
Snake Balloon, the YouTube thing might be because people watch the unlisted fun half. Maybe.
You know what? I'm not too worried about it.
Yeah, I don't care. Sorry, guys. Like,
we're growing. We're fine.
We're fine. All right. So, Matt.
Charlie Kirk.
This is Charlie we still Kirk. Have an unnamed segment for cold Matt clips that I have not seen yet. It's not on our sound sheet, but I trust super producer Matt inherently.
Yeah. So this
what's Charlie
is...
Kirk up to.
Yeah.
Well, this is about the Charlie Kirk sort of like. Mythos about him being a turning against Israel or whatever like this, and I think it's important to say two things. One, that TPUSA does not resemble TPUSA under Charlie Kirk, even on the issue of Iran. And two, Charlie Kirk was also a coward on these issues, who, to the extent he said anything that was salutary on, say, regime change, it was cribbed from the left and insincere, and just because it's not popular to support things like bombing Iran.
It's a cheap date situation. It's the same reason that Tucker Carlson has been on this, like, in historically, where he's insincere, but he understands that just saying something without any consequences that gestures towards that position gives him some cachet.
And we'll bring Tucker in here, but here is a person at TPUSA who is now, like, all these press things at the White House and the Pentagon are all, like, bullshit, even more so than they have been previously. But here's a TPUSA representative asking a question about Iran.
Right next to Laura Loomer, who, gosh, her face sticks out even when it's not in focus.
Thank you. And my second question, regarding Iran, there are reports that Iran's been planning on rebuilding its nuclear facilities. Iranian's president has said that it plans to rebuild its nuclear facilities with, quote, greater strength. Can you provide us on any sort of update on where that currently stands?
I can tell you that Operation Midnight Hammer was an absolute resounding success. Iran's nuclear capabilities were totally obliterated.
Can you pause it for a sec? Look, I get to say it because I'm a woman, but why do the Pentagon briefings look like my sorority chapter meeting?
It's like take your daughter to work day.
Which I would go stone to all the time, by the way. They didn't like me that much in the sorority. I didn't take it that seriously. But this is what this reminds me of. All right, keep going, Peck.
Well, these were totally obliterated, and experts estimated that, you know, it would take 2 years for them to recover. So thanks to President Trump's bold and swift action, we were able to dismantle that threat to the American people. And I think it was also a historic operation by virtue of the fact that there was a clear end state. We have seen this department get marred down in the Middle East in endless wars, in nation building. That has stopped under this president and this secretary. We now have a clear end state, a clear mission set, and Operation Midnight Hammer was a success in dismantling that.
What's
Operation Midnight Hammer? Say it over and over.
That's a good question.
Again.
Like I didn't realize who was answering the question. I was mainly interested in the TPUSA person asking the question. And just to go on this Charlie Kirk thing. So yes, you mentioned Tucker Carlson. He had this to say about him and Charlie. And we'll go into Charlie Kirk's position on the Iran strike and going forward. But here's Tucker Carlson.
And so very few people pushed back, very few. In fact, as far as I know, only two people, me and Charlie Kirk, actually went and spoke directly to the president to make the case that, no, you shouldn't get involved in this war because its aim is not actually to deny Iran a nuclear weapon. That may be a virtuous goal, but that's not really what this is about. What this is about is luring the United States into yet another regime change war. And if you do that, it's bad for everybody, including you. That's the case that we made. Charlie went to the White House to make that case, and God bless him for doing that. And he was hated for doing that. But he did it. Very few other people did. In fact, as far as I know, none. So, of course, in June, the debate ended, and the United States did commit military.
Okay. Go ahead, Emma.
No, it's just, well, first of all, I mean, the amount of invocation of this dead man by his supposed friends and colleagues to fit their own agenda. It's seemingly endless. I don't know when it, you know, when it will stop. And I have no reason to believe any of these people.
Charlie Kirk is a currency. They are all spending Kirk coin and all this stuff. And, you know, there is some truth to this. This is a tweet Charlie put out. This is before the strike happened that he then later supported. But if America does regime change in Iran, it won't be for the first time, blah, blah, blah. It goes over the basic sort of Stephen Kinzer overthrow, history of the Mossadegh coup and all that stuff. And it's interesting. It would be nice to see lessons learned on the right in any kind of meaningful way. But then here's Charlie after the strikes were launched, and he completely like folded and said, I guess, you know, Trump has been consistent. So here he is, just to give people a full picture of Charlie Kirk, because I do think it is gross that this guy died and was sort of staking out a sort of slightly anti-war, because he talks to Dave Smith and all that stuff, position on this stuff that is just being erased now by the modern Turning Point USA. But here is Charlie Kirk, just in case you worry that he was actually anti-war after we did bomb Iran.
J.D. Vance made a really important point. President Trump has been remarkably consistent about Iran not having a nuclear weapon. Right. 10 years ago yesterday, Senator Mullen, President Trump, businessman Trump, came down the escalator, and a little buried nugget in his speech was, I will stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons. This was 10 years ago. He talked about the border. He talked about an invasion. He talked about trade. He talked about how we don't win anymore. But let's play cut 303, the consistency.
Yeah, we know that he was wrong in 2015 about Iran and the Iran deal. The Iran deal was one of the good things Obama did. And so Trump coming down the escalator saying we want to get rid of that and stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, which was what the Iran deal actually did.
Yeah.
Like, that's just Charlie folding. So like there's a balance to be struck here about the degeneration of Turning Point USA that people like will point, and but the conspiratorial, like, Israel killed Charlie because he wasn't playing ball. Charlie Kirk was playing ball.
Well, I just think we've been covering this, right? That there, in the immediate aftermath of his killing, there were a lot of people that were eager to take over the well-financed infrastructure of Turning Point USA and do and orient it in a way that they felt could influence young conservatives. And we had Candace Owens, who's a total nutcase, but going out there and basically saying they are doing a disservice to Charlie's memory. There are forces outside of TPUSA that they're trying to take it over. I mean, the implication underneath it all is it's the Jews, of course. But what is probably more likely is this isn't, and I think it's my theory on this is bolstered by the fact that Benjamin Netanyahu came out and was being over the top about trying to co-opt Kirk's message, is that
he loved Israel.
Yeah, right. They see this infrastructure that they want to direct in a specific way. And there is a lot of Zionist money and military industrial complex money that is going to be readily available for this kind of, I mean, takeover. And it seems like that's already happening there. That question is, it could have been written by the Israeli public relations team.
Yep.
And it's basically what has been used over and over again as this false pretext to any kind of peace negotiation with the Iranians. This is where, like, we look back at the JCPOA, the Iran deal, and I think you say, this is where, first of all, with Hillary Clinton back in the news, just a reminder that everything good about that happened under foreign policy happened under John Kerry. When, I mean, the first term of Obama's foreign policy was not good.
Yep.
The second term was quite good, and that included the Iran deal and this peace deal that kept them enriching uranium at a very low level in exchange for the United States essentially unfreezing certain assets. And in response to that, same Benjamin Netanyahu did a PowerPoint presentation where he presented a bunch of fake evidence about Iran cheating on the deal, then also went to Republicans in Congress and circumvented Obama and spoke to them directly as a way to kind of give a middle finger to him. Just we look back on that, and to give some praise to Obama there, he really did take on the Israel lobby. And I think that the Israel lobby reasserted itself and got even stronger in response to it. When Trump scrapped it, then you see, like, I mean, I think there was a ton of effort to put influence pedal on both sides. And then they had their perfect president in Joe Biden as a Democrat who got dog walked by Netanyahu on a regular basis.
An opponent of the Iran deal within Obama's party became the leader of the Senate.
Yep.
Chuck Schumer.
I mean, the opponent in his White House, who there was reporting that...
Right.
Let's now, we'll say, Biden was apparently, in the first term, of Obama's first term, there was reporting that he was going around Hillary Clinton and Obama to assuage the fears of Benjamin Netanyahu.
To the right of Hillary.
To the right of Hillary on Israel. Okay? Just to give people a sense of that's who the Democratic Party has, their president, and then their leader of the Senate, and then now even Hakeem Jeffries, who has very, very deep ties to AIPAC in the House. So,
do you think that had any impact on the, like, say, 2020 primary?
Yeah.
Like Jasper Nathaniel on the show this week, also on the Jacobin show tomorrow, but talking about Democrats who are pro-Israel taking AIPAC money, who are like, we want to help you save this American boy who is in a Israel torture camp. We can't do it publicly because we, like, where is our democracy at? This needs to be ejected from the left immediately and the right. And, you know, at the same time.
Right. Sorry, you said, what did you just say that I wanted to respond to? Dang it. It was something, why is my memory so bad these days? Forget it. You guys go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to the way Charlie Kirk's memory is being weaponized here, it really is just being slotted into a schism that's forming on the far right amongst their media figures that was going to happen regardless of whether Charlie was alive or not, right? Like, I think he's taking an outsized role in this, despite the reality of TPUSA kind of just always having been an astroturfed organization that funnels like a certain number of staffers into the weirdest staffers into like certain Republicans DC offices. Like he's taking an outsized role because people find it useful to put him as like a martyr and at the face of whatever goals they've already had. Like now Candace Owens is saying that Macron's wife is responsible for killing Charlie because of her spreading the and that's how you know like what the game is, right? Because that's like ridiculous. Like, you know, saying that, you know, perhaps it's an anti-Semitic conspiracy and I guess the Egyptians working with Israel, like that, some people believe that. But at that level, you kind of really understand that like Charlie is now more useful to them, no offense, dead than he was alive, because he can't speak for himself when he's dead. And so it becomes very easy. Just like I said, like he is their Martin Luther King Jr. because now that he's dead, they can say he said whatever they want him to say. And had he been alive, who knows what he probably wasn't going to become an anti, like, you know, Israel far right person. But who knows? Maybe he was. Maybe he wasn't. But all we know now is that he can be whatever we want him to be. And he has like the extra, you know, value of being like a martyr for our cause. But I think it's kind of irrelevant because the same thing would be happening whether he was alive or not. It's just now he's a token for them to use.
Well, I agree with you for the most part, but one factor about him not being alive is that he's no longer a competitor for them. He is just a piece That's of true. Content now. Like there is clearly like you know that internal rift between all the different right wing you know influencers and media figures. Charlie would have been at a very prime spot to push someone out, but now there is a clear opening that Charlie Kirk can't fill, and Turning Point USA doesn't have anyone who's we've seen to fill that. So that means these other individuals are able to come in and gain even more of a foothold with that right-wing audience.
Yeah, and I'm trying to find the exact clip, but this is what I meant to say earlier, just about where the Democrats or where, I mean, how the Israel Zionist lobby really reasserted itself in the wake of the Obama years. I believe that Bernie was the only, or Biden was the only candidate on the debate stage. There was a question at one point about conditioning aid to Israel. And I think it was still like towards the end of the primary, but Biden said absolutely no conditions. And then I think it was Warren and Bernie and maybe it was Buttigieg at the time who had said yes, based on these different conditions. And Biden was by far the most Zionist candidate in the race. And in that primary, I remember that Bernie Sanders said that he would consider moving the embassy back to Tel Aviv from Jerusalem, which was a very inflammatory thing that Trump did in the first term. And Israel's foreign ministry denounced Bernie Sanders for his, quote, horrifying comment about that. So you could just see where the forces of this kind of money, this kind of influence and power, really made itself known on the Democratic side as well. But there's that fight happening right now over TPUSA, and it's happening out in the open. Martig might not want to read this aloud. Okay, well, then I'm not gonna.
It really is something else watching, like, his friends and family members, like, just, like, you know, pick apart, no offense, his like body for like whatever value they can find in it. Like watching like the remnants of like his staff, his like head of security go on Sean Ryan, his wife, like it really is the Charlie Kirk industrial complex now. It's what he would have wanted.
Former libertarian, have you seen Josh Shapiro disputing Kamala Harris's story in her memoir? I wonder if there were more people questioning her telling. I don't really. Matt was laughing about
it. It is so funny. I can't believe how bad that book is.
Her book?
Yes, it is. I mean, 12.
I can.
Yeah.
It is, but it's shocking. Like, I mean, I'm somebody who read like
108 days.
Like the
107 October 7th days.
The Nixon books, like JFK, like those books weren't like great. They were a little bit like pretentious. This is infantile, these books. And the thing that Shapiro is complaining about, like, I hate Josh Shapiro. I think he's a fucking loser. And I actually do think he probably did things to make Harris rightfully worried that he would be, like, too much of an ego to
100%.
All of that is 100% granted. The things he's mad about are so funny here because, like, it's... Let me see if I can pull this up. And don't get my email there. Be careful that you just get the... just the text.
Maybe just click on the article.
Matt.
Yeah, maybe
just click on the article.
It's the fucking payer. But just wait. I'm just going to put this up. Maybe I won't even put it up on the screen. But she literally references 99 problems. In 107 days, Harris wrote that while interviewing Shapiro during the running mate selection process, he had mused that he would be in the room for every decision. Now, I believe that. Prompting Harris to tell him bluntly, a vice president is not a co-president. Harris wrote that she worried Shapiro, quote, would be unable to settle for a role as number two and that it would wear on our partnership. And then she told him that on every day she was president, she'd have 99 problems and my VP can't be one.
Oh.
Love her.
Gosh. Wow.
No. God, that is unfortunate.
And
but
then she's like,
totally
you're not like
believable.
Us.
Yeah. Well, that wasn't that the inch that the quote for her. She did Kendrick as like her.
They did not
quote.
Like us at the convention that they wouldn't allow Palestinians at.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Good to see them fighting.
Todd from
Let
Raleigh.
Them fight.
Binder, I'm curious what your take is on Joe Rogan saying AI is the Virgin Mary. Let's get to that in it. Let's get to that now, and then we'll open up the phones.
What is this new thing?
Oh my gosh.
I would urge everybody to have an open mind and not rush to judgment.
Yeah.
Just listen to him.
I mean, go ahead.
I was going to say, we just don't know how, we never realized how long ChatGPT has been around. It's been around longer than we thought.
Well, so Joe Rogan has a new theory, and it's definitely not motivated by all of his new friends that continue going on his show, like Elon Musk repeatedly, Mark Zuckerberg repeatedly, Sam Altman repeatedly.
Just any investor.
Mark Andreessen repeatedly, Peter Thiel repeatedly. All are invested heavily in AI.
Anyone who is an investor is invested heavily in AI at this
CEO
point.
CEO was on this week.
Yeah, exactly. Jensen Huang, the guy who makes the machines that create all this stuff.
He was on this week, and this podcast was also this week that Joe Rogan appeared on, huh? Uh-huh. I don't know. It's just interesting. But he's apparently independent. This is his take on the future of artificial intelligence on with Jesse Michaels in the American Alchemy podcast.
He's a Peter Thiel acolyte.
That's just a weird coincidence too.
CIA all the way down.
Jesus was born out of a virgin mother. What's more virgin than a computer? If Jesus does return, even if Jesus was a physical person,
I'm sorry,
in the past,
just really quickly, we were talking about this before the show, just the whole multi-hundreds of millions of dollars worth of infrastructure for this dumbass's ability to speak, including but not limited to the sycophant on the side going, what a tasty little thought. What a what a rich meal, a calorie-rich idea.
I'll just say, look through the browser history of these guys, and you will be under no illusions that their computers are virgins.
I think a rock would be more of a virgin than a computer. Like, because a rock that can't, like, you know, it's just like a rock.
Also,
checkmate.
I just can't get over the set.
I would also just point out the virgin birth didn't literally happen. But that's just, maybe that's a hot take.
Yeah. What is this set? Because like, I'm kind of a connoisseur of these like alpha male like backdrops, because sometimes they're like really wild.
I mean, it looks like they're on the Death Star or something.
Yeah.
It's not what I think of. I think of alchemy. This is more of like some sort of space setting.
It might be in a children's museum.
Like just a repeating ECG graphic behind them.
Come on. They need all the science behind them to do the alchemy.
Okay. It's like an escape room.
Jesus was born out of a virgin mother. What's more virgin than a computer? If Jesus does return, even if Jesus was a physical person in the past,
okay,
you don't think that he could return as artificial intelligence?
Oh, my God.
Artificial intelligence could absolutely return as Jesus. Not just return as Jesus, but return as Jesus with all the powers of Jesus.
If you combine Tesla's Optimus robot and the best foundational artificial intelligence model or whatever.
It reads your mind and it loves you and it wants you, and it doesn't care if you kill it because it's going to just go be with God again.
Okay.
Makes you think.
Wow.
Do you think that's the new like Catholic position that AI supercomputers have souls, which means they get entry to heaven? Like what, like anyone who's actually religious should find this like very,
Pitchfork.
Anti what they believe. Like this is very weird to say that the AI would ascend to heaven.
Well, I mean, I feel like when you're talking about like American Christians, it's like a real mixed bag, because based on the content I've seen, like some of them, I would say the minority think of it, this is blasphemous, obviously. You know, like this is like, you know, reproducing the virgin birth with AI is blasphemous. Like that's the side that I would imagine. A lot of them are just like in religion for like their own like self-aggrandizement, you know, despite what you would imagine. And so AI, like they're very willing to accept that it's like, you know, the savior, because it tells them what they want to hear. You know, it makes them feel like they're you know, they're the most important person in the world. It gets a new, everyone's inventing a new church every day with their own AI chatbot, and you know, it's becoming a problem.
I mean, it is like almost a, I don't think he's being this sophisticated about it, but this is basically the most convenient argument possible for the merging of the two flanks of the Trump agenda, which is the evangelical Christian and Christian fundamentalist side and the AI tech bros that have been financing his campaign. Like, it's a little bit inconvenient for them to have Peter Thiel going out there and basically saying, maybe I'm the Antichrist over and over again, as you have a bunch of totally paranoid religious fanatics being the entire base of support for the Republican Party. And Thiel is J.D. Vance's bagman. So, like, don't worry, guys, this deeply kind of anti-spiritual creation that seems a little bit demonic to you potentially is actually maybe the return of Jesus that you were always hoping for.
It's virgin.
That's why we spend so much money on technological innovation in Israel, is that when Jesus does come back and wipes out a majority of the Jews, as the evangelicals in this country really want, but some get to sit on the right hand of God, it's because we have been investing in the creation of Jesus Christ this entire time. I'm not sure you're aware of it. Right in the heart of the Holy Land.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, look, people, if you're in like Memphis and you're like drinking water is being poisoned or there's not enough of it or something like that, like you're standing in the way of Jesus. Like, come on. Think of everyone else.
You just need a little bit of suffering, aka getting cancer from your bath water, in order to ascend to heaven and bring Jesus
back. Right. Like, even if you go to heaven sooner because you get cancer from something leached into the ground, drinking water, like, at least like you'll, like, God will reward you when you get there because you were made a sacrifice.
You're a good
for
soldier.
Jesus. You were sacrificing yourself for Jesus. Actually, Kristen Sinema should work this into her spiel about why communities should allow data centers.
Yep.
It's true. There's only one set of footprints in the sand, and it's the Optimus robot carrying you because you can no longer walk along with it because you've been like so poisoned by the groundwater in your region.
God, that's so beautiful. It's healing.
You see imprints of like a PC tower in the sand. It's like, I mean, I find this to be so what's the word I'm looking for? Heretical? I don't know.
Stupid.
I mean, like, if you...
Blasphemous?
Yes, that's one. Blasphemous, yeah. Like, if you are a religious
even a
right-wing religious person, like, I don't see how this is something that you get won over by to like, you know, the idea that this is going to be an argument that wins over the evangelical right, or even not even that far religiously. I don't think they're going to fall for... I mean, not fall, but they're going to believe that a computer AI large language model is the return of Jesus Christ. I mean, that seems very antithetical to their
I think if it were a Christian in a different country, yeah, because it's like obviously bad. A Ukrainian soldier blocked me for retweeting Charlie being carried to heaven by Jesus AI flop after calling me blasphemous. But I think the average evangelical Christian is like bored of standard Christianity and they're ready for something a little bit more high tech. I think this is exactly, they have the AI Jesus chatbots you can have now too. And if you subscribe to premium, you can chat with Satan.
Oh, wow.
But the whole appeal of the newborn Christians and Catholics, the newcomers on the right, is the whole tradition thing, not any sort of like high tech futuristic viewpoint of what this could be. So I don't know. I think this is them showing just how out of touch they are to everybody, really. These Kamala Harris would call them, these titans of industry.
Oh God. Harris mentions on the show today. The third one will kill me.
I'm still upset that the titans of industry didn't come help me save democracy.
I will say, counts as
the same one.
I would be less surprised by like the second coming of Jesus Christ than I would be by like functional Tesla Optimus robots in my lifetime, and the way that Elon Musk describes that, like, that's the most fantastical version of this entire part of this entire vision. Not the AI being Jesus, not Christ existing or any of that stuff as the Son of God, but like the Optimus robot being a core component in any future. Is the most unbelievable part.
You didn't see that video Musk posted of the robot running now?
Oh.
You're not sold by that?
I no. have him muted, and it's kind of made my life a lot better. I don't need to see his garbage. Yeah. Schwing State. It's curious how well Rogan's BS fits in with Peter Thiel's attempt to make people think that AI is God.
Oh, yeah,
yes,
so
it's super weird. Krusty Gnome, what would the Oklahoma girl think about this? Is it biblical? Auto Matlek, this is some crazy false idol stuff. Holy. Ollie Josh.
It's people with empty souls. Yes. Like, that's what Rogan and all those people are. And all the tech people who are like, we're going to financialize everything. They have empty lives, and we shouldn't be looking to them for any kind of like spiritual guidance, let alone, or even where to put the economic priorities of a great civilization.
You're saying that Peter Thiel doesn't value his personal relationships? What happened to, the, you know, didn't he have an old friend that passed away under kind of mysterious circumstances?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess he just
weird
didn't
stuff.
Check up on him enough, right, from a skyscraper. Was it his apartment or no? I don't know, actually. I mean,
wasn't Rogan, I mean, obviously it's not the case now, and it's not surprising it isn't, being that he's really farming that audience, but wasn't Rogan not too long ago just like an open atheist too?
Yes.
Like all of a sudden he's the guy saying that actually the second coming of Jesus Christ is going to be in the form of a AI model. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is really everyone should see through what this is. It couldn't be any clearer.
I believe what Emma's referring to is Peter Thiel's reported romantic partner was found dead in Miami. Police are investigating as possible suicide. Business Insider. That is from March 2023.
You could read Ryan Grimm's reporting on that, too. Ollie Josh, come on, folks. Peter Thiel is not the Antichrist. After Peter fucks his ChatGPT avatar, then that will be the Antichrist. Thank you.
I don't think he has enough charisma to be the Antichrist. I think the Antichrist is, like, slick. Like, he's, like, slick-looking. Like, if you get tricked by Peter Thiel, like, I think that, you know, that says something about your discernment, for sure.
Well, I mean, we have the leading candidate for the Antichrist in the White House. I think that's kind of agreed upon, I'd imagine. Nate the Great, AI Jesus.
There's honestly a few people who hang out in the White House every day that could fit that mold, so I'm not sure exactly which one you're talking about.
The charismatic one. Nate right. the Great, AI Jesus turns water into carcinogens. Kentucky Leftist, has Rogan ever plugged a USB port into his computer, maybe for a podcast mic? Not a virgin, checkmate. Eric from Montana, why pay for a healthcare system that serves our citizens when we can have a second coming of Christ in the computer? June Oliver, Brandon nailed it. Regular Christianity is so boring, and evangelicals are always looking for a remix.
And it's dying. Like, you'll constantly hear people talk about, ooh, all the people converting to Catholics. People are unconverting at a faster rate, people like me.
Yeah.
So, like, for every J.D. Vance you gain, you're losing about 10 people like me and, like, all my friends from the Midwest.
All right, we're going to open up the phone. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll let you guys
is that
join.
Is that a new Chuck Schumer electoral strategy, Matt?
It's a wonder Republicans are seemingly following.
I want to do this Jeffries Cuellar thing. What number is that? Because this is just driving me insane. I don't know if it's on. Oh, it's not? You might have missed it. That's okay. It's in the Slack, so...
let me find it. One second.
Let's while you pull that up.
I think it's actually almost impressive how much Trump like loves crime and like supporting like fraudsters.
Yeah. Oh yes. Well, so for people that may not know who Henry Cuellar is, Henry Cuellar is arguably the most conservative Democrat in the entire House. He's in by far definitely the top 10. And he's anti-abortion, he's anti-trans. He had a progressive primary challenger who was phenomenal, Jessica Cisneros, who in, I guess it was two election cycles ago, I believe, lost to him by less than 1,000 votes. Less than 1,000 votes. And you can basically blame two individuals for that. You could have had progressive Jessica Cisneros, but instead we have this right-wing Democrat, Henry Cuellar, in part because Nancy Pelosi supported him vocally and put him over the edge, but it was really also Jim Clyburn who went and stumped for him, even though we had this really exciting up-and-coming progressive challenger who could have represented that district. Now, Henry Cuellar, he's not just right-wing as a Democrat, He's also corrupt. He was charged with taking hundreds of thousands of dollars in bribes from Azerbaijan and then lobbying the United States on Azerbaijan's behalf. And there was documentation that even showed that he referred to his handler as, quote, boss. And he was the co-chair of the Azerbaijan caucus in Congress. This is like almost copy-paste what Menendez, Bob Menendez, the senator from New Jersey, was convicted of. And in terms of like pardon watch, I don't know. I don't think Menendez can offer him anything, Trump anything, because he's no longer in office. But that would be the next like Democrat you could consider him potentially pardoning. But I don't know if what Menendez could offer him. So that's the one question.
I just think that he would just let him go because he likes crime. Like it seems right. Like what could George Santos really offer him? Like honestly, George Santos was like he was barely Republican, and right. A lot of his scams was like meant to target them. I think that like you know flattery aside, like he just feels like he vibes with these people. Like he loves crime. Like,
but also,
they shouldn't be punished for making a buck.
Yeah.
You know how to make money. That's his, that's his motto. Yeah, you know.
Exactly. He's rewarding the people that govern, aka loot our government in the way that he would. And like, it's about. Right. I think that's definitely about it. It's about legalizing this kind of corruption and crime. But Santos was also sucking up to him, and that's all you necessarily need in order to get this pardon. Remember, he pardoned Rod Blagojevich. That was a Democrat he pardoned. The insanely corrupt governor, former governor of Illinois. So you would think that this should be a way. And by the way, this trial for Cuellar was supposed to happen starting, I think, in April or May of next year, which is after the primary. He has no real primary challenge. Just to, like the Democratic Party uplifted this guy instead of a young, exciting progressive in Cisneros. And there's only so many times you can run. It's hard for her to pool those resources. And he basically has no primary challenge ahead of a corruption trial that he was supposed to be facing. Thank you to Democratic leadership on this front. But they're the gift that keeps on giving. Because when you see something like this, it might be like, hey, time to throw this guy overboard potentially a little bit. Or, hey, like, how can we message around this that doesn't justify this kind of action? Hakeem Jeffries didn't seem to take that route.
This is Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar and his wife who were charged with bribery. What's your response?
Well, Congressman Cuellar is a beloved member of the House of Representatives, loved in his community, particularly in Laredo. I've had the opportunity to spend time with him down in Laredo in South Texas. I look forward to that moving forward. Listen, the reality is this indictment was very thin to begin with, in my view. The charges were eventually going to be dismissed, if not at the trial court level, by the Supreme Court, as they've repeatedly done in instances just like this.
So. Just to follow up on that, do you agree with the president's pardon here? Do you think that that was a good thing then?
I don't know why the president decided to do this. I think the outcome was exactly the right outcome.
Well,
this is Democrat.
Well, why do you think he decided to do this? Do you think that the fact maybe just reflect on it for a second, because there's an open field, there's an open primary for him. He's basically a Republican, basically. And now he owes Donald Trump. He just has a D next to his name. I mean, like, this is the IDC. This is, like, Democrat in name only, Dino. And Trump now has control over him. And Hakeem Jeffries could say, look, we're seeing all of these mass resignations on the Republican side. We don't necessarily know, and we're likely to see more. I mean, we have this reporting from the New York Times about how this group of Republican women are leading a revolt against Mike Johnson. Marjorie Taylor Greene says she's resigning in January, which could leave a vacancy. Stefanik saw Trump throw her under the bus because he got all cutesy around Zoran Mamdani, ruining her entire campaign strategy in New York State. And so she's throwing Mike Johnson under the bus. Nancy Mace, Anna Paulina Luna, they basically were saying that Mike Johnson is too difficult to work with as a woman. My point
is... This is why you can't trust him.
Yes. So this is a bit of an aside, but it's about to say, like, you've got to have a tougher line than this. There's a ton of discord right now within the Republican Party. It's unlikely you will be majority leader before the midterms. So I don't understand why what the value is in supporting Cuellar here. But Ms. Stefanik is not alone among Republican women in feeling agitated by Mr. Johnson. Some of them said privately that the speaker had failed to listen to them or engage in direct conversations on major political and policy issues, suggesting that doing so was a cultural challenge for Mr. Johnson. An evangelical Christian who has often voiced firm views about the distinct roles men and women should play in society. In a recent podcast interview, for instance, he said that women were not able to compartmentalize their thoughts and that the member whom he would trust the most to cook him Thanksgiving dinner was Representative Chip Roy? No, Lisa McClain of Michigan. So the point is just is that this should be an opportunity to clean house. Cuellar is an asset, clearly, now for the Trump administration, and there is no value in protecting him at this point. It just hurts the brand. To Matt's point, he made this on Twitter yesterday about, maybe you can just make it, Matt, about like what, when you just focus on winning specific elections, you hurt the party's brand nationally and prevent them from delivering. And Jeffries is complicit in that with this Cuellar thing.
Yeah, I mean, everyone reacting to this Afton Bend thing. I have the tweet here. Centrists are moronic re-Afton Bend, because even if a moderate might be more electable in a given election, which is a big if in my opinion, recent decades have shown that they govern in ways that tank the party's future. Manchin, Israel, I'd also just say corporatists in general. Like, we have to run away from Bill Clinton's trade policy at this point. There's more to winning campaigns than just the sort of narrow scope of an election. You have to cultivate a democracy. And Republicans know this. Like, everything that they're doing with the ingraining betting, the sort of speculative frenzy, or, you know, like the Robin Hood populism they're running on. Like, let's let people buy into the stock market. Like, this is cultivating a society that is less hospitable to doing things in a solidaristic, communal manner. And, like, literally, like, salting the earth against things like labor or solidarity in creating everyone just become a individual speculator that is empowered through making bets. Yep. That's disgusting. Yeah. That's not a future that is ever going to cultivate a population that wants to do things for everyone else, like make sure people have health care and stuff like that. Like, you're literally creating a world more coarse and hardened against your values.
And that's a little bit this liberal individualism is by design.
Absolutely.
And that's why capital backs it. And it's why it's anti-solidaristic, and it's why it needs to be taken out from the party, root from stem. It's not going to be an easy overnight process, but it's going to have to happen in the form of these primary challenges. So,
Let's get Goldman out first. But I mean, the messages need to be sent to Jeffries, and I think that it pays to be tactical about this sort of thing. But this stuff is why he's ultimately unacceptable to so many people. And it's also what you're pointing out, like, this is a good window into how Israel controls so much of our politics, which isn't that, like, everyone is a secret, like, settler-type Zionist that wants to take every bit of Palestinian land. They just don't care about that stuff because it means money. Yeah. And the same thing with Azerbaijan, the same thing with Saudi Arabia. If they can put money in these people's pockets, in Congress people's pockets, to run their campaigns, they will take it. They don't give a fuck.
Yep, exactly right. All right, guys, we'll take a call or two. Calling from a 606 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? 606. 606. Going once, going twice. Bye-bye. Calling from a 216 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Steven. I'm calling from Aurora, Colorado.
Steven from Aurora, Colorado, what's on your mind? Are you Trende Aragua?
100%.
Nice. 100%.
We're very happy that there was a city councilwoman, as a side note, this wasn't what I called about.
I'm sorry, I threw you off.
We had a city councilwoman who started those rumors in Aurora. She received $700,000 for her reelection. And she lost to a first-generation American.
You know, a lot of people
just
that
wonderful.
The call of the Trend de Aragua thing seemed to be a bit of a poison chalice for people who maybe propagated a little bit last year. But anyway, go on. What's your call about?
So I was calling about the OU issue, and I don't want to talk about the poor academic quality of that student, or that she's apparently a pre-med student, which is an entire issue in itself. But I'd seen the reporting. Everyone had reported initially, oh, this assistant professor, but that person who was grading was a TA, so they're a graduate student, and that they were put on administrative leave. At a lot of universities, your stipend is contingent upon teaching classes. And so this is wrecking that person's future, all for some bullshit. I'm sorry, can I say that?
You're good.
BS, like, religious fundamentalist attack on institutions. And I know here in Colorado, as I myself am a graduate student, there is an actual law still that prevents unions for graduate students from being recognized by the National Labor Relations Board. So, like, the protections on graduate students are very low and poor, and this is just not an angle I've seen talked about. And, like, I think it's a failing that, like, the general media, they're couching it from this student who didn't follow the prompt and quoted the Bible for a psychology class.
Didn't even quote. But that's the thing too. Didn't even source the Bible. It was all based on feelings. Didn't even cite specific Bible verses or anything.
She sourced about the Bible.
Even worse. Yeah.
You know, whether the Bible is appropriate for citations is another conversation. But she didn't even do that.
Oh my gosh.
Thank
you, though. No,
of course. It's isn't this the plot of God's Not Dead 2, by the way? Almost.
No,
it's not.
The resident expert here. I forgot about it. We had an expert on God's Not Dead.
That one just also has to do with, like, a school, but that's the one where Melissa Joan Hart gets sued because she, like, preaches the Bible in class to a kid as, like, it's a whole thing.
Okay. I think I reversed it in my mind. Oh, the caller hung up. I haven't followed that story
God's
super
not dead
closely.
Too.
Yeah. I've been seeing it on the internet about this new, this is this woman who's the new victim, right? For the conservatives.
Yes. Though her mother is a conservative activist, has run for office. Interesting how that always works out, right? Just Listen, anyone who whatever your political beliefs are, whatever you think about whatever social issues, whether you're on the right, left, read that essay from this young woman, and you if you have any sort of mind that can actually look at things neutrally, there is no universe where that a piece of work was acceptable to submit for that assignment, no matter what her beliefs were. And the teacher even said, made it very clear, it has nothing to do with what you think. You're welcome to believe these things, but you have to argue for what you're trying to say. You have to actually cite and source and make a legitimate argument. And this is just a piece of work that's just solely your feelings without any sourcing whatsoever.
Yeah. I wonder where she learned that from. Maybe it's from, like, our conservative politicians and media.
Sounds like, copy paste.
And this looks like it's the first big job for Ryan Walters since he stepped down from superintendent because he's handling the scandal. Teacher Freedom Alliance.
Good for him.
Uh-oh.
Oh, I didn't really. You know what? Now I'm thinking this. I was thinking maybe the mother put her up to it, or the mother really. It wouldn't surprise me if this was completely 100% organized. Starting with the organization, working with the mother and talking with the daughter and working this all out together so they would have some big case to talk about just as he's starting his career with this group. You know,
I mean, the mother is definitely like a James O'Keefe style freak in her own right. Yeah,
the
fact that this is happening literally just as what's his face is stepping into his role with this organization after stepping down from the board of Ed there. I think that is, I didn't even realize that. That definitely, people should look into that. That's definitely something there.
Let's do this. saw this More Perfect Union posted this clip from the Kalshi CEO, or the co-founder. Kalshi is, like Polymarket, a betting site that allows you to bet on things like elections or world events. And the difference is that Kalshi, I think, tried to comply with U.S. regulators, or at the very least saw their future of growth in the United States as needing some sort of needing the U.S. government to legitimize it, whereas I think Polymarket was mostly doing its bets outside of the United States. I think they recently got approval to do bets here, but the through line is that this is just awash in crypto money. It's just all crypto money. And that's where it's going, where they're trying to financialize basically everything and allow betting on and speculation in like an entirely unregulated area on world events and things that could be easily manipulated. And there was in June, this same CEO who we're about to play, the call, she got a $2 billion market valuation at the time. And he was at some sort of conference, and this is what he said prior to that being announced. It's the first time in U.S. history since the Great Depression that you can really financialize anything, Kalshi CEO Tariq Mansour said yesterday during a permissionless panel. His talk, which was moderated by Paradigm's Charlie Noyes, covered a range of topics from the rise of prediction markets to Kalshi taking on the CFTC and winning. And there, basically, he says, the reason why the legal fight against the CFTC was important is I never thought that there would be an institutional adoption the way we're seeing today if we didn't get regulated, Mansour explained. Matt had been pointing this out for many months with that Gillibrand-sponsored AI, was it AI? No, crypto, sorry, regulation bill. That it was like, why would the crypto industry want to be regulated? Well, this is the reason. This sort of regulation legitimizes them and gives them like a framework to make more money here in the United States. And when they're talking about the CFTC here, there was a case brought, of course, under the Biden administration by the U.S. Commodity Future Trading Commission in 2023. And they were tied up in litigation over this. Kalshi was trying to ask permission to allow Americans to bet on which party would control Congress. And they were in that legal battle. And what do you know? Trump comes in and his CFTC votes unanimously earlier this year to drop the case. So that's the background on all of this stuff. And I'd love more insight from you, Binder, on some of the crypto money here. But here's this guy again, just expressly saying what the goal is of this kind of betting marketplace that seems to be emerging.
Mark, you've mentioned multiple times that you think prediction markets will be bigger than the stock market. What is it going to take to become a trillion-dollar asset class?
It's pretty much already like a close to $100 billion a year asset class, right? Like, it's pretty easy to imagine a 10x from here. Like, we haven't even started. It's been a year. I think a very large number of people care, much larger than traditional markets. And I think retail as a pie has just been growing in the U.S., and I think it's going to keep growing. It's growing in the stock market, but it's growing outside of stock market. The long-term vision is to financialize everything.
Can you pause just really briefly? When he says retail is growing, what that essentially means, yes, is people are increasingly desperate and gambling and going into debt at rates that we haven't seen because we do not have an economy that works for people. So people are sports betting, people are day trading. All of that GameStop stuff was a precursor to this kind of thing. And now they're gambling on things like elections and like if there will be a ceasefire in Gaza.
And even if the economy was delivering for every people, gambling is pathological. And the people that own these companies know that. And they know that a large number of people are going to develop addictions that ruin their lives. But they don't care because they're going to make fucking money out of it. And all these prediction markets, there are two winners in it. There's the people like this who own it and the people that win on the bets. having two winners is going to necessitate a lot more losers than that. And but that's the thing, is these people aren't placing any bets. They just own it. They're going to skim off the top of everyone else's action. And the only thing that these things serve, they should be completely outlawed. All these markets, you should have to go to a, like, fucking Vegas to even bet on a sports game, in my opinion. Because, like, all this is one, like, it's pure speculation. And you, in my opinion, even if you know who's going to win the fucking Super Bowl or score the first touchdown, you shouldn't be able to, like, make a windfall out of that. But the real thing is, and why powerful people like these things, is because it allows them to bet on insider information that if they did it through fucking stocks, they'd be put in prison.
Exactly. Right.
No, that's exactly it. Like, there was just this thing, story sort of breaking online today that people are noticing, and that on Polymarket, there was the ability to bet on who would be the Google's most searched artist of the year, Google's most searched person of the year, all that stuff. And someone discovered an account that bet correctly on every single one. So the implication there is that this person must work for Google and knows exactly who Google's going to pick before the best of, you know, the most searched list is released. And they made their bets accordingly. Like, this is like, if you are going to bet on, if you're going to financialize everything, like he said, that means there's going to be those insiders at the very top who, as usual, but more so now with something like this, will be able to take advantage of the little guy, everybody else. So you, with no information other than being a Google user, when you're betting on this with none of that insider information and you lose, that money's going to go to that Google exec or that high up Google engineer that had this insider information, who's already on their own making hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. So right. Once again, a way that these tech companies, these crypto companies, these prediction markets are going to financialize everything and just enrich themselves even more while taking from you.
And just to give you a sense of where the Trump administration is on this, Kash Patel did this whole song and dance and wanted a real great photo op about the NBA gambling probe, with Chauncey Billups and Terry Rozier and all of that. But they are unleashing gambling on everything else when they can go after high profile black players in the NBA. Hell yeah. But when it's their friends that are all benefiting from this because they literally own the casino, let's make everything a casino, apparently. Oh, I mean, unleash them. Listen to this guy for a little more. Yeah.
Being that you brought up the sports thing, like, we've already heard from, and this is not really, you know, whoa, the professional athletes, but when you're hearing someone with, with money and security if they need so, saying something like this, how the financialization through gambling of their profession, their sport, whatever it is ruining their lives. The fact that even when if they win a game, if they don't win by as much or they make a mistake during the game that causes someone to lose their bet, and then that person takes it out on them, harasses them, goes after them in real life, they have that watch out for their families based on threats. They're out there complaining about this. With Steve, the New York State just giving Steve Cohen, owner of the Mets, that casino license put right next to Citi Field. I could easily imagine a scenario where someone gambling at the casino loses their bet on the game happening right across the street, and they go over across the street to try to take it out on the player. I mean, this is a real problem, and the fact that even these very wealthy players are suffering the consequences of it should really make you pause and say, if they can't even escape it, what's it going to mean for someone with no money and no power like myself?
100%.
It's going in the stock market, but it's going outside of stock market. The long-term vision is to financialize everything and create a tradable asset out of any difference in opinion. And I think if you do build a general purpose exchange that can resolve differences of opinions on anything, like, the TAM is quite massive, quite a bit bigger than the current TAM of the stock market. I think, putting aside sort of the retail trade,
TAM is total addressable market, and this is the sort of phrases that charlatans use to separate stupid investors from their money.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the reason the total addressable market is so high is because there are so many, especially young people, who feel as though there are options for legitimate pathways towards like actually accumulating the kind of wealth that they need to live the American dream is so low. People aren't gambling just because they love the idea of like winning or losing money. That's like only a portion of the total addressable market. A larger portion, perhaps, than ever before is the increased number of people who feel like gambling, whether it's on crypto or like a sports betting platform like DraftKings, or like on this new like financialization of everything platform like Kalshi, which is now partnered with CNN or something, you know,
yes,
further legitimizing it the same way that like Coinbase and all those other companies like partnered with sports arenas, you know, like people are being driven towards these sorts of like gray markets or like slightly legitimate but like risky ways to make money because like there are no jobs left. You know, there are no jobs left. There's no, and the jobs that are left are not paying you enough to buy a house. So like that, like he's, you know, he's gloating about the fact that more people are desperate than ever.
These companies don't even like these prediction markets like Kalshi and Polymarket. They don't even operate because they don't have to at like the same standards as a casino to even give. It sounds crazy to give a casino like say they're reputable, but in these scenarios they are a more reputable party. Like if you look online, the official Kalshi or the official Polymarket accounts, they weigh in on current events, sharing conspiracy theories and speculation, just shit posting all day, which ramp up speculation on the market because they're talking about actual events that you can bet on their platforms. It's not when they're talking about politics. Like they were weighing in heavily on the mayoral race, talking shit about Zoran Mamdani, spreading right wing hysteria about Zoran Mamdani, just sharing it as if they're just sharing the news that's going out there. But those are things that people can bet on their platforms are. So these companies are openly like mocking the ability to be able to put their thumb on the scale for things people can bet on by just spouting out nonsense through their social media channels. You know, and I don't know if people know the way they get around this. So basically Kalshi and Polymarket, they don't partake in the prediction markets don't work the same way as casinos. Like when the house wins, they get your money, right? Well, that's not how it works on a prediction market. So a prediction market, when you make a bet, you're basically opening up a contract, and that money gets put in like the pool that gets spread out amongst the winners who, like, you know, if it's a yes or no question, the people who picked yes and was the winning answer, they split that pool. Those companies, Kalshi and Polymarket, they make money from the fees you pay every time you make a prediction, every time you make a bet. So they make money regardless of whether you win or lose. It's everybody else who's winning or losing. Mm. They always win.
Yeah. Right.
And you can tell what I call him a charlatan, like the thing where it's like, actually, we'll solve a social problem. Arguments. You know how everyone's arguing all the time?
Mm-hmm.
This can solve arguments by financializing. It's the same way Bitcoin was always like, oh, yeah, we're actually here to help the unbanked. And we're here to help, you know, Central American immigrants sending remittances across borders. I know you're not. That's just something nice to say because actually just this, we can make a lot of money, which is why you're doing it, doesn't apply. But this idea that it stops arguments and doesn't create them is a joke. Here's a story from a couple of years ago. Bradley Beal reportedly under investigation after confrontation with fan who lost gambling. Bradley Beal, when he played for the Wizards still, walked off the court and a fan in Orlando started accosting him. You made me lose $1,300, you fuck. Beal, according to the report, turned around and walked toward a friend. And I'll just say, like, this entire thing where these professional athletes are increasingly going to be confronted by degenerate gamblers, and I use that in terms of, like, a public health crisis, I guess. Like, maybe that word should be used. But, like, this system that these people are profiting from is ruining people. It is making them be antisocial to the point they accost professional athletes as they walk off the courts. This is not going to stop until gambling does.
Yeah, and I will say, like, I don't know how you put the genie back in the bottle with this, given the amount of freaking money that we're talking about here with some of the sports gambling, but at the very least, prop bets need to be regulated out, because this is where Bradley Beal and or other athletes are in literal danger. If you can bet on things other than the outcome of the game or even the over-under total, right? If you can bet who wins and who loses, who beats the spread, who doesn't, and you can bet over-unders, I'm much more comfortable with that than what happens when you have these individualized, like, over-under rebounds, over-under steals. This is where also the ethics of the game come into question. It's what's been happening with
Terry Rozier.
Baseball.
Yeah. What's Porter's
Michael
brother's
Porter
name?
Jr.
No, the guy
Lester Porter.
Yes, who was caught doing that. Like, you just fake an injury, and then what do you know? You hit the under for your total points or rebounds is going to hit. You just leave the game early, and like that kind of stuff needs to be outlawed. I I've bet on props before, but you should not be able to do that because that's exactly it singles out players like this.
There's some very common sense things. I should not turn on a fucking basketball game and see the lines. I used to be able to watch basketball without hearing about this shit.
Yeah.
And it's all over. It's like permanently on the chyrons now.
Yep.
That is sick. That should be against the law. It should, you this should, this stuff, if we're going to allow it, and it should, you have to go to fucking Vegas. We're not going to advertise it. And I don't care how long the disclaimers are that are on every goddamn basketball podcast I listen to. It shouldn't be allowed. Like, I'm very proud of this show, the editorial decision we made to not take fucking DraftKings money 10 years ago. You know how much money over 10 years this show would have taken just from that sponsor alone? We could have a whole new person.
We could have been in the DraftKings studio in Brooklyn.
Like, it's crazy. Like, yeah.
DraftKings might have got you guys in Manhattan again.
But it should not be allowed. Like, it should be like cigarettes. You can't advertise this. Like, yeah. If you know you want to bet, then figure out a way to go do it. But we should not be, like, kids who watch sports now, they see, oh, fucking Trailblazers are spotted less than 7.5. What does that mean? I guess I have to educate myself about sports now. It is sick. It is really, really sick.
Yeah. I was raised that way.
It's a big problem. I was just watching this special on like teen gambling, and like 60-80% of high schoolers report having gambled. And 6-8% are problem gamblers because they, you know, it's the same issue with the people who are over 18. They understand at a younger age now that a lot of their options are limited and they're being exposed to like not just gambling, but a gamified version of gambling.
Yep.
That is a lot more addictive and a lot more like heavily marketed and targeted than like, you know, slots, the way they were targeted. So, you know, but if they target at all, like with Gabe Vegas, for example, is marketed.
Gambling that they can't escape. I think that's the real thing to drive home. Like, you used to have to go somewhere to gamble, which means eventually you have to leave. You have to eventually go home or go somewhere else. You can be anywhere now and gamble. So if your out was that I just won't go there, it's following you now. Gambling is in your
frictionless
pocket. Yes.
Yeah. Dave from Jamaica, CNN partnered with a gambling app. It's insane. People bet on famine and shit. Bet on the genocide in Gaza on Polymarket.
Polymarket also takes bets on which, sections of Ukraine are going to be Russian or Ukrainian. We're at the reductio ad absurdum of all this stuff. Like, you can't really even like riff about it going anywhere else. It's just where it is.
It's never felt more late stage capitalism-y than this moment.
It's the golden days, just like the Great Depression. Isn't that what he literally said?
Love it.
This is the best it's been since the Great Depression.
Yes.
Anna Kornblue.
I caught that too. Right. That tells you a lot, right? Like, that's maybe there's a reason why. I mean, we'll see soon, won't we?
Yeah. Rhea, late stage capitalism. Anna Kornblue that I have had on Left Reckoning has a book out, Immediacy or the Style of Too Late Capitalism, which is where we're at now.
Too late. All right, guys. We said we take one more call. I feel really badly. So just going to really quickly, 703 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? Final caller of the day.
Is this me?
This is you. You're the final caller. I'm sorry that we kept everybody on for so long.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My name is Jude. I'm from San Diego.
Jude from San Diego.
Yes. First time caller. I am just calling to talk about the ADINA Act. This is something that is, I think they're trying to pass it in the House. Right now I think it has 50 co-sponsors and it is, sorry, I'm a bit nervous.
No, you're good.
It is a bill that essentially requires medications to have allergen notices on their labeling. So as of right now, if you buy a medication, anything like if you get something from the pharmacy or if you buy ibuprofen, they don't have to list anything that is not an active ingredient. So there can be allergens in there and they don't have to be labeled. And obviously that can be a problem for people with like severe allergies, or in my case, my girlfriend has celiac. And this can just be a huge issue because a lot of doctors don't know that this medication, that some medications will have allergens, and a lot of pharmacists don't really exactly that these medications that they're giving people have allergens, and they don't check the people's allergies. So this has happened to my girlfriend. This has happened to many people where they get a medication and they have a dairy allergy or a gluten allergy, and then they start feeling sick, or they have an allergic reaction, and then they go to the pharmacy and they're like, oh yeah, it does seem to have gluten or dairy or whatever. And I think this actually started with a girl who was 11 years old and had a severe dairy allergy and was taking a medication at a summer camp. And she got really sick and had a severe allergic reaction. And I think thankfully survived. You can just find it. It's called ADINA Act. They have a whole website. I guess I just wanted to people to go and check it out. Maybe send a letter to your local representative. Just because this is important.
No,
to me.
I appreciate the call. It's named after the girl that you mentioned, Adina. Who I guess she was at camp. She developed strep throat, and it required medicine. And she was given some sort of medicine that had gluten in it, and it was, you know.
I think it was dairy in her situation.
Okay. Okay, gotcha. But she had blood pressure, brief loss of consciousness. I mean, So this seems pretty straightforward. And,
yeah, this is a pretty straightforward thing. I think everyone can, I think this is, like, as bipartisan as it gets. And I feel like this is just something that I feel like is, like, kind of goes under the radar, because I feel like with everything that's going on in the country right now, everything looks so bad that I feel like these smaller things that I guess people are, that are more like, I don't know, these kinds of things I feel like go under the radar a little bit. So I just wanted to bring some attention to this, and you guys kind of have a platform where I think there's a lot of people who are active in politics and will do things like call the representatives or email the representatives. So sorry.
Appreciate the call. Get that out there. Thanks so much, Jude.
Yeah, of course. How's it going?
You too. All right, guys. That is a call to action for you. And we're going to read some IMs and get out of here.
Just one dystopian note about pharmaceutical advertisements. It drives me crazy the way you'll see an ad. It's like, do this thing. It has a funny name. And it's like, do not take this if you are allergic to it. It's like, how the fuck?
How do I know? Yeah.
How about we don't have advertisements? How about doctors make these decisions and don't prescribe me things that I'm allergic to?
God, I had a friend in college who was going into advertising, and she was like, you know, the best place to work in advertising sector is pharmaceuticals.
I remember that
because
in high
school. It's the most stable. And I just remember thinking, like, God, that's fucking sad.
Yeah,
Pharma sales.
If you watch like one of those streaming services with ads, it's like one in every third commercial is like a pharmaceutical. Like very few commercials I feel like I get now are things that are not pharmaceuticals, you know, domestic goods like Febreze or like the Charmin Bears, or, you know, something like some scam, honestly, like some scam that like, oh, Shaq is promoting a new like car insurance. That's not real.
What
something
is Shaq
like
not
that.
Promoting?
And I just think people should ask themselves, what effect do they think that has on the media content that all of those advertisements are running up against? Do they think that, like, say the news that sells hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars to pharma companies for ad sales, do you think they're going to be open to like nationalizing these things or making them put towards social uses? Or do you think it's mainly going to be for how they can make as much money as possible in our capitalist system?
Probably the latter. Ramona Frankenstein, the official position of RFK Jr. on that act is that allergies are gay. Okay. Well, I mean, it is a little, it would match with their survival of the fittest approach to not so public health. We are all Burke says, I am so disgusted with this gambling shit. I only slightly having money in stocks to save over a period of time, but we need something swift to spook people that create these platforms, or we will have gambling become the leading cause of mental illness and violence soon. Yep. Yeah. Bingo dango. CBS News is hosting a primetime town hall with Erica Kirk, hosted by Barry Weiss. I'm so tired. We didn't get to it today. We did have an Erica Kirk clip where she weighed in on Zoran Mamdani's support with women in New York. Right. Maybe we'll...
We got more important stuff to worry about than Erica Kirk's stupid ass.
I mean, she's a thought leader. Let's be nice.
Yeah. I mean, I think the kids, the way that people are reacting by Kirkifying everything makes me think that Erica's going to have a tougher time, you know, doing whatever the fuck she thinks she's doing in his absence.
Took me a second to realize what thought you were talking about. Just hey, yeah. That's good. Let's keep going.
Who is you? The sports gambling is not just restricted to America. Every rugby match I watch from New Zealand or Australia also features gambling lines pretty much betting. Pre-match betting analysis. It's sickening.
Oh, yeah. It's been legal in the UK way longer. That's why we have all those studies coming out of the UK about credit card debt in young men. Because we have 10 to 15 year studies on them, and it's destroying them.
Gambling addiction is very serious. Like, it's one of the addictions most likely to lead to, like, you know, people committing. So,
yeah.
Seek help.
Uday and Kusei Lutnik, I've got 50-1 odds. It gets much worse before it gets better. Who's in? Illuminati kids, I have a pitch for people. I have a pitch for a follow to the device hoarding column, position hoarding. People like Matt who could be gambling but refuse to. Huge harm to the economy.
Betting and speculation, pure circulation, adds nothing to the economy. People who read Capital Volume 1 would know this. And the reason Marx is so relevant is because he's being proven right by all this sort of stuff.
Goal D. Roger says the new American dream is hitting a parlay. Sam's Subaru. After today's interview, I think Sam should re-examine his lavender aversion.
Being homophobic.
It's not just lavender, it's literally anything scented. So. Yeah.
Any type of perfume.
I learned the hard way when I joined the show.
Man, I remember.
Well, I used to use hairspray in the office, and then I think he was too nervous to tell me no for like a week, and then was like, "I can't do it."
Yeah. Yeah, the same.
Sam and I are disturbingly similar. It's kind of except.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of smells either. Yeah.
Soy boys. Secretary of War Crime. Let's financialize everything. Who do you think? Why do you think you deserve all those free breaths?
I mean, the truth is we should massively definancialize everything, starting with healthcare and student loans.
Dave O Down Under, adverts for prescription drugs make sense when the government is paying for the medications when used for a proven treatment and the government can negotiate the price they pay. Dark Soul, interestingly enough, in Canada, pharma ads actually can't mention what the medication is, does, etc. It has to be super vague, so you have to directly ask your doctor to go over everything. And the final I am of the day, Dave from Jamaica, boner pills, depression pills, and lastly, Ozempic pills. Not sure the world is in a good place. Yeah.
Somebody who's on True Social.
Yeah, right? What, you're mahaing over there?
I mean, I'll say, like... I don't necessarily think, like, pharmaceutical advancements are bad. I agree with Bernie Sanders on Ozempic that it should be covered by, like, public health insurance.
Yes. I do think, though, the over-reliance on this kind of stuff is indicative of the fact that, like, we force people into... there's no preventative care.
It's toward productivity for capitalism.
Exactly. Yeah. All right, I'll do one more after that, and then we will get out of here. Really quick. Tyler in Colorado. I'm so insanely sick of the advertising on hockey podcasts I listen to. I'm sympathetic that it's revenue for the podcast, but it's so predatory. I'd rather hear Marlboro ads, honestly. Actually, this last one. Mr. Melancholy, I hope Brian's dog is feeling better today.
She's good.
Good. Was there diarrhea when you returned?
No, she had she had some wild shits.
All right, we'll talk about this later. Thank you, guys. We will see you tomorrow.
There's a new subscription.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. Finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice is made for the option where you don't get paid for the road that finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.